Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Yeah, greetings from Florida. We have winter. Winter has descended upon us. Of course, for us, it's a little different than the rest of the country, but it's still cold and it's a little scratchy. You know, my voice this morning, but I shall endeavor to get through what could be a lot of talking on my part here. But this is one of these thinking shows. This is one of these things that I don't think radio producers and operation directors and media consultants would ever consider doing, which is actually having people think. So we're going to spend a lot of time today with concepts, with ideas, and this isn't the first day we're going to do this, or the only day we're going to do this. We're going to there's a lot of things to journey through. And as I begin this journey through a government without bureaucracy, it's going to take, this rabbit hole keeps getting longer, you know, and so I'm already thinking, well, I really need to study the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Romans and find out how their governments worked and how their governments didn't work. And so I did the same thing with education several years ago. In fact, we have a new website coming out. WriteYourLaws.com is going to be unbelievable. And we're taking our time with it because we want it to be done right. And there's still going to be work to do even after we bring it out. But just as that was a big one. And one of the things I want to do with the website is put Greg's blog. So I'm going to have my own articles there. That way I don't have to worry about, you know, other websites editing, saying it's too long, you can't say what you want to say, because I wrote a 14,000-word article on education and a new model for it. Well, that's a long article. I would not recommend reading it all at once. It's, you know, it's about a 4 or 5-time read. But I went through all the ancient education systems of the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Romans, the Greeks, the Middle Ages, the Islam education when they had an education, not, you know, barbarism, a lot of this going on right now, but back when the Library of Alexandria in Egypt was the finest in the world. Of course, it was destroyed. But it was interesting to sort of draw on all those traditions up through the one-room schoolhouse to the factory model for schools that we're operating under now. It's basically an 1800s factory model. And so what I want to do for government is kind of the same thing I did for education. And that article, it was published on the Intellectual Conservative. Unfortunately, they got hacked and everything kind of changed with that website because the last thing that the left wants is for conservatives to be intellectual. And so we're going to do it anyway. I mean, we don't care. But so once I get my own blog, I'll be able to put that article and put what will become, you know, a series of articles, I think, on government as we kind of wade our way through that. But before I get too ponderous here, I wanted to bring Gina, producer, in the conversation and also see if there's any particular news items that she has or wants to talk about before we get stuck into our main topic. And this is kind of how Mondays are designed. We've got 2 hours before Dr. Pry joins us. I sent him the article, the primary one that I'll be drawing from for today's discussion. Of course, you're welcome to join me. You know, feel free to interrupt anytime, 215-383-3832. But I always like to check in with Gene and see if there's anything, you know, particularly pressing. I've got a couple of stories to sort of, you know, whet your appetite, and then we'll get going from there. Gene, good morning. Have we got you on the line here? Or are you busy redoing the world here and keeping the show working?
Good morning. I'm on the line. Well, you know, I have not been keeping up with a lot of news that's been going on the last few days. Mm-hmm. Except, interesting, last night I heard, I was listening to someone and they were talking about Dr. Fauci being, you know, I don't know how they said charged, but I guess he hasn't done anything to it, or they haven't done anything to it yet. But India, I think it was the India Parliament or Indian government is suing Bill Gates.
Well, funny you should say that. I just happened to have an article.
The death of a teenager. Yeah.
I just happened to have an article. Let me see if I can see where I put it. I've got a couple of different sources here, and I'm trying to group my articles into blogs because otherwise they get I get too many windows open and we have problems here. That's not it. It's actually the Indian court, and I've got an article. The original one I found was from the Indian was from a source. I think it was Health Impact News or Natural News, neither of which I can post on Facebook because they're immediately gotten rid of. And so what I need to do is find out where I put it. This will just take me a second.
It was just interesting because someone that was also listening to this person talk was like, where did you get that information from? I can't find it anywhere online. And they were like, well, yes, you're not going to find it online in the United States. And they said, you have to go to da-da-da-da. And it's like, how interesting. I it's like you get some false news, but I sure hope this is true because at least some entity is looking out for the betterment of their people. Because I didn't watch much, but I've seen him talking on the mainstream media this weekend. I don't want to put this so much on radio, but I'm just going to be blunt. He's like a TV whore. I mean, he can't get enough of himself being on TV and talking to people like he's some sort of authority when it's like he's anything but in my mind.
I believe the term you're looking for is psychopathic narcissist. Would that about sum it up?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Because there's
this show's all about being blunt, by the way. don't hold back.
No, so smug, and like condescending. And it's like, wow.
Well, he actually said that the public good reigns supreme and you have to subvert your individual rights and liberties to the public good. And of course, who defines the public good? He does, right? And this is why this is so dangerous. So anybody, and this is why I've been so adamant about rewriting laws like our public health laws in Florida and the other things to make them subordinate to the Constitution, which of course is where they are, but I want to clearly state it. So there's no ambiguity, there's no doubt in anybody's mind that no matter how bad the emergency, you still have your individual rights because any emergency can be solved and still maintain your rights. What we don't want to have is that the emergency becomes the way to suppress your rights, which is really what's going on, okay? If you have a hurricane, and people are suffering horrible tragedies, you still have your rights, okay? Granted, things are going crazy, but you still have your right of self-defense, okay? Like they took the guns away from people after Hurricane Katrina. You can't do that. People still have their self-defense rights. You can clean up the buildings. You can rescue the people. You can do all the things you have to do in an emergency, okay? Same thing with a pandemic. It doesn't affect everybody. You're going to protect your most vulnerable, but people still have their individual rights. You don't close their businesses down. If it makes sense to do, people are going to do it anyway. I always point to the draft as an example. In Vietnam, they had a draft because nobody wanted to go. Why? Because it was a war that shouldn't have been fought. Okay. I'm sorry, all the veterans in this area, it shouldn't have been fought. Okay. But in World War II, they had a draft, but they didn't need it because so many people volunteered. They volunteered in such excess numbers, they were turning people away. Why? Because the cause was just. A, we got attacked, and B, Hitler and Hirohito and these folks had to be stopped. It's just too bad we didn't stop Stalin at the same time. But if the cause is just, people are going to do it. If the vaccine is safe, people are going to take it, okay? The reason people are resisting and willing to give up their job is because they know it's not safe, all right? So if you mandate the fact that you have to mandate something proves that there's enough doubt that it's not safe. And if you respected personal liberties, it wouldn't be a problem. Okay, and you still have the right to make bad decisions in this country. So if some people make a wrong decision, incorrect decision, and suffer the consequences, that's okay. But what you're finding out is that more and more people are suffering the consequences, making the right decision. And that's why personal liberties are always stronger. Individual liberty is always supreme over anything else. And it has to be that way. Otherwise, you don't have a free society. And government, whenever anybody that thinks that they're acting in the public interest, anybody that thinks they can act in your public interest is wrong. I was thinking about this last night, driving home, I was working all day yesterday outside. It's probably why my throat's a little scratchy. But what actually is the public good and what actually is the public interest? And I came to the conclusion that the only thing that truly is the public interest is the collective decisions of everybody individually. Okay. So what everybody does individually, the net effect, the cumulative effect of everybody making individual decisions is the public interest because that's how the public expresses their interest through individual decisions. How's that?
Right. That's so true. So true.
Yeah. Yeah. That way you maintain your freedom and you can talk about the public good. Yeah.
And the thing is, if Sweden virtually has no COVID and they have virtually nobody that's gotten the vaccine,
That
tell people something right there.
Yeah. How about the fact that doctors and nurses and health professionals and lab techs and everybody else, we have a lab tech coming up on Wednesday who's going to remain anonymous. And so we have some really special things coming up in the show. But we are going to protect people's identities just because of the world we live in now. But yeah, and all these folks they know things. They know, everybody knows what the problem is, who's in the health professions, but they can't say it. And that kind of suppression is only able to take place in a totalitarian society. Because if you have the free flow of information, none of these really bad policies would happen because they'd be stopped by the free flow of information. So
right.
it comes back to freedom protects you. People don't understand this. Freedom protects you. Freedom of information protects you. Freedom of individual decisions protects you. You know, and again, I really like this definition. What is in the public good and what is in the public interest are the collective effect of individual decisions. And I think that's really key. I want to talk about Omicron for a bit because it seems nicely timed to coincide with Christmas. But the Indian Bar Association, this is where I got this from. So here's the way you play the game, or here's the way I play the game, social media. I know if I post health impact news or if I post natural news, the article will be immediately censored. So I go to the source. You know, the source of the world's first vaccine murder case against Bill Gates, Adar Poonawalla, filed in India's high court. I went to the Indian Bar Association. Okay. Everybody's got a website now. This is great. So this was posted November 25th, so just a few days ago. And you know, I'm pretty sure it's the Indian Bar Association. I don't think this is a fake website at all. First of all, there's a lot of Hindi writing on it, which I can't read. And that's a good indication. Most Americans, if they're faking it, would not put Hindi on their website. So it says, world first vaccine murder case against Bill Gates, filed in India's high court, Kiran Yadav versus state, and ORS.criminalwritpetition.st.18017 of 2021. That looks pretty official. That looks like a court docket to me. Okay, so I think this is definitely a genuine article here. It says, petitioner has sought prosecution of AstraZeneca's COVID shield manufacturer, Bill Gates, his partner, Adar Poonawalla, and other government officials and leaders involved in the murder of a 23-year-old man who lost his life because of vaccination. They're stating it right out here. There's no equivocation here. It's right there. The deceased took the COVID shield vaccine by believing in the false narrative that the vaccine is completely safe, and also owing to the compliance requirement set by the railways that only double vaccinated people would be allowed to travel. Okay, so there you go. So killed by government policy is basically what this is. The government of India's AEFI, that's Adverse Event Following Immunization, probably similar to our VAERS system, I guess, committee has recently admitted that the death of Dr. Snehalunawat was due to side effects of the COVID shield vaccine. Now, we don't have the AstraZeneca vaccine here. It's interesting that Bill Gates, American, allegedly, is funding AstraZeneca, which is more of a European, Indian, and I guess Asian vaccine. We don't have it here, which I find interesting. So Bill Gates is willing to kill other people in other countries and make money, but he doesn't want to do it here. He's using different vaccines here. I just find that interesting. Anyway, a petitioner has claimed RS 1,000 quarters, $134 million compensation, and has asked for interim compensation of $13.4 million, so 10% down payment. Petitioner has also sought lie detector, narco analysis test of accused Bill Gates and others. This is a fascinating case. You know, I hadn't actually read it all the way through. I was going to do this in a different day, but now that we're here, you know, we might as well spend a few minutes on this. In the case before the American court regarding the side effects of MR vaccines, that would be, I guess that's messenger RNA. That's probably their short form. The court accepted the settlement of compensation of $101 million U.S. dollars for the victim. Wait a minute. What American court paid out $101 million? Like, I didn't hear about this. This is another case in America. The CIA, FDA's Office of Criminal Investigation, recovered around $10.2 billion U.S. dollars from pharma company GlaxoSmithKline for various offenses, including suppression of side effects of medicines and putting the life of Americans in danger. That's a previous case. I remember that. You know, the pharmaceuticals have paid out literally billions of dollars for their criminal actions. So the idea that anybody would trust a criminal enterprise with no liability for their vaccine manufacturer, you know, with your life, to me is irrational. Call me crazy. That's how I see it. So if you get a chance, Gene, if you want to look up $101 million U.S. settlement from court, from, I don't even know where it is. This is American court. I don't know. I just, I can talk bureaucracy here in a minute, but that's fascinating. What do you think?
Yeah, I've not heard of that one, but wow.
Yeah.
But yeah, it makes sense. And I'm glad they're starting to hold him accountable.
Mm-hmm. Funny how that didn't make the American press, isn't it?
Yeah,
both
exactly.
Of the other pharmaceutical cases, yeah. Well, along that same line, I was just watching this before the show. I found it on another website that the 60 Minutes report of the swine flu is back. and they talk about the woman that got Guillain-Barré syndrome, and it's all the same stuff. The government mandated it. Jerry Ford gets on the TV. Everybody has to take this. They had sports stars. They said that Mary Tyler Moore took it and recommends it, and of course, then they interviewed Mary Tyler Moore back when 60 Minutes actually had journalists. You know, Mike Wallace, not Chris Wallace, his liberal socialist kid, but Mike Wallace, the real journalist, and was actually interviewing people, and a guy in the government program, you know, he asked, did you ask Mary Tyler Moore if you could use her name? No. Did you get permission? No. Why are you doing it? Well, I don't know. You know, it's really funny. But what's even funnier about this, and I made this public on my Facebook page, so anybody wants to go to Greg Penglis, you know, my Facebook page, this particular post is public. And after the 60 Minutes report, they had a commercial for Camel cigarettes, all right? Now, here's where it gets really funny. It was for doctors. And because it was a medical report, right? So they already had the medical aspect tied into the commercial. And it said, which cigarettes do doctors recommend most? And you see these doctors smoking in labs, smoking in, you know, in front of patients, you know, smoking, you know, surgeons, technicians were, you know, nurses, doctors were all asked what cigarette they think is the smoothest. You know, and as the survey says, Camel cigarettes. And I'm just falling off my chair. This is hysterical. I'm watching this commercial for Camel cigarettes on which cigarettes doctors recommend most. Can you imagine that coming on today? Yet it's not that different from the vaccine ads, really. Anyway, I find that fascinating. Gene, you want to play around those cases or you want to talk bureaucracy? What's your pleasure? Because I'm going to talk bureaucracy. I know, tough decision.
Yeah, let's talk bureaucracy. The reason I say that's talking about these cases, even though it's real people that got affected.
Yeah.
Wow.
It affects you.
I don't want to go into that energy this morning. Sorry, people.
It's
overwhelming to think that our the government's not always never into the well-being of the people. It's the well-being of themselves. We just have to look at everything that's going on in D.C. to know that.
Yep. The next thing we need to look into is Glenn Beck on The Blaze is looking into the patents that Dr. Fascist owns, the genocidal psychopathic narcissistic vaccine drug pusher. See, I'm going to add narcissist to his title. Okay. Just he's going to go crazy. But yeah. So genocidal psychopathic narcissistic vaccine drug pusher, Dr. Anthony Fascist, has a bunch of patents. And of course, he needs to be audited. All right. So let's go back to the beginning of Action. Well, not the beginning of Action, the Action Radio show. And so I started. At 1330 AM WEBY here in beautiful downtown Milton on the banks of the Blackwater River in Florida. And we're up in the panhandle here. And so my boss, Mike Bates, was nice enough to let me try Action Radio for the first time when literally hundreds of other stations across the country, I know because I asked them, said no. So I got to try this year. And my idea originally and still is that any person with a good enough idea can write a bill, change the law, and have it end up on the president's desk. The real one, not the moron who's there now, not Brandon, but I mean a real president. And one of the first things I came up with were two bills for actually extra government departments. And people are like, Greg, you want extra government departments? Well, hear me out. The first one was the Department of Freedom. And the second was the Department of Innovation. And so the bill I'm going to talk about is the Department of Innovation. I wrote it November 11th of 2017. And so the point of this was to have a government department specifically designed to clean up the other government departments to bring about, you know, the future plans for the 22nd century, in other words, 100 years from now, and to look at the whole idea of bureaucracy as a model. Is this the best way to have a government? And so I've brought that idea back. You know, it's always been there. It's in the back of my mind all the time. Originally, my plan was to get folks like Newt Gingrich and maybe Thomas Sowell and, you know, some other folks, Candace Owens, you know, thinkers, Marjorie Taylor Greene, thinkers, really interesting people, conservative, you know, really strong voices out there, different people together. And Mike Huckabee, you know, I'm just random people just popping into my head in like a brainstorm committee. And unfortunately, it's taking too long to do that, so I'm not going to wait. I'm going to start forging ahead now with this bill. And so if you go to writeyourlaws.com, that's WRITEYOURLAWS, writeyourlaws.com, you'll see what was one of my very first bills. And I said, we don't have a government department engaged in really long-term planning. We had the same problems going on year after year, and no one is set up to do anything about that. So it made sense to have an agency dedicated to making the government run more smoothly with the latest technology, with private industry best practices, and to be able to find out where the inefficiencies are. Second paragraph. This department will prepare the government for the 22nd century by planning long in advance for the future. Also, it will go over the entire federal bureaucracy to remove duplicate programs, waste, corruption, entrenched civil servants that do nothing, and set the government up for minimal resource, maximum output. The department should be a laboratory for new, creative, and better ways to govern. Could incorporate a private component to inspire private innovation and ideas. That's what we're going to talk about today. What I've done is I found several articles on bureaucracy in eliminating corporate bureaucracy, and what I want to do is apply the corporate bureaucracy elimination model to government and see what that would look like. That's what I'm going to do over the course of the next, you know, hour and a half or so. And again, anybody wants to join me, feel free. And so you might want to listen for a bit, but, you know, as we get into the discussion more, please feel free to hop in. All right. So, okay. Review how, here's the last sentence of the second paragraph. Review how we do military contracts and choose weapon systems. Is it for jobs or military needs? Military and weapon systems, budgets, cybersecurity. So I got to clean that section up a little bit. It's been a while since I've looked up, but you get the idea. So we're going to look at government bureaucracies, look at military contracts. We'll look at different things. And here's the third paragraph. This department will also improve and restructure all interactions of private citizens with the federal government to include transparency, simplified forms, all forms in English, removing all racial and ethnic classifications and distinctions for any function of government, give direct access to those affected by specific government policies to reach the people who made the policies, hold, quote, town meetings across the country so people know what services are available, and to open up the process so no agency or department becomes insulated from those affected by their policies or the general public. Can I bear in mind, I wrote this 4 years ago. All right. And so this is the formative stages of Action Radio. But it's interesting. You take a look at some of the things that I discovered this myself. I'm like, wow, I wrote this. Well, it's interesting. And applying directly to what we're going to talk about as we get going here. Next paragraph. And there's only two more. This will be a department that regulates other departments. Probably the biggest challenge will be the General Services Administration, which runs all the buildings. The Department of Innovation may replace the General Services Administration. Salaries and compensation for the Department of Innovation to be determined by how much money they save the federal operating budget, how creative they are, and how fast they bring the rest of the government into the latest technology and practices. Okay. Jean, do you have a comment now? The last paragraph really applies to what we're talking about today. I didn't find this till I read the bill, which is a couple of days ago. Yeah.
No, you keep going.
Okay. Last paragraph, regulations and regulatory agencies may be an obsolete way to govern. Okay, and I'm reading this going, damn, I wrote that 4 years ago. I like this. Think about that. Regulations and regulatory agencies may be an obsolete way to govern. Okay, you're not going to hear that anywhere else, folks. I mean, this is, you know, people are trying to make bureaucracies a little more efficient, you know, cut their budget a little bit, but they basically aren't challenging the premise that a bureaucracy should exist at all. And that's what I'm going to be doing today. Okay, this is kind of a revolutionary show as it goes. All right, so if regulations and regulatory agencies may be an obsolete way to govern, is there a better way? Probably the most important function of the Department of Innovation is to analyze not just the duplicate and overlapping regulations in place, but to analyze whether the process of regulatory agencies issuing and enforcing regulations is a model we want to continue. Regulatory agencies have become their own governments. They have their own budgets, promulgate regulations within the agency, enforce those regulations.
Hey, Greg, you're going in and out at times.
Oh, well, that's no good. All right, let me see if I can. What if I'm getting too close to the microphone again? I'll start this. Thank you for telling me. All right, has it sound better now? I'm backing off the mic a little bit.
Yeah, you were on like 95% of the time, but every once in a while, I missed a sentence.
Yeah, and these are kind of key. So let me just back up a little bit here, turn my volume a little bit so I can hear me better. So yeah, okay. So we're good at this range. This sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Let me just start this process here. Regulatory agencies have become their own governments. They have their own budgets, promulgate regulations within the agency, enforce those regulations, collect fines, and enforce judgments. They have given money collected from judgments to leftist special interest groups like the EPA during the Obama administration, and they have, at best, minor oversight from Congress. Can they come up with a new way to enforce the laws, but without the separate and powerful regulatory agencies and departments with a permanent bureaucracy where individuals work decades longer than the representatives and senators who govern them? That's the bill. It's more questions than answers.
Right.
That's probably something I don't expect an answer right away, Gene, because I mean, I've been thinking about this for 4 years. You know, you're just hearing it now. And so, but just an initial, have you ever thought about maybe there's a better way to govern? Maybe there's a different way to govern. Maybe there's something else that we can do rather than just trying. It's like education. I don't want to reform government education. I want to get rid of it. Okay. I think a privatized education system with parents exercising, you know, through the choices they make for their kids, you know, and if the parents can't afford an education, a full voucher system, and then a system of vouchers, tax credits, tax deductions, you know, so that no, you know, and even I would even give vouchers to, you know, people that don't have kids simply so that you can donate those vouchers to the school of your choice, because you're being taxed for education. So why shouldn't you have a voice in the education system? If you want to donate to a private school, you want to donate to a ballet school or a flight school or a sports, you know, little league, I don't care. But I think that would be the fairest way. If they're taking the money anyway, you know, why should only people with school kids be able to spend it? Just a thought. Anyway, what do you think?
A lot of sense to that, yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, well, it's going to be on our next bill. Reform education, that's going to be in there. All right, so the basic idea is to ask questions. And generally, just to give you my thought process on how I go through something like this, the first thing I do is I'm a big believer in not reinventing the wheel. So what's been done already? How can I save time? How can I look to different, you know, civilizations, different periods in history, different times? And in this case, different ways of operating. And the first place I went, I did some general searches, you know, and the search was to how do we eliminate bureaucracy? And I found this article, which I posted on Facebook. I think, I don't know if I made it public or not. If I didn't, I will. You can all look it up, though. It's from the Harvard Business Review. It's called The End of Bureaucracy. Now, Harvard's really good about this. I mean, you know, for the elites, you know, for the people that rule the world, they're really good about educating. You know, what the government education system through the state universities and state colleges give to people is, you know, makes you a good cog in the wheel. But the elites, the Harvard, the Yales, the Stanfords, you know, those kind of schools, they really do some interesting stuff. Excuse me. Again, voice a little scratchy this morning. And so the article is titled The End of Bureaucracy, How a Chinese Appliance Maker is Reinventing Management for the Digital Age. And this is by Gary Hamel and Michelle Zanini. It's from, I guess it's from the Harvard Business Review magazine, November, December of 2018. So this would have been right at the height of the best of the Trump administration before the COVID, you know, collapse under Dr. Fascist. And so these were good times. And so it's interesting that a lot of times you look at the times an article comes out and you can kind of see why it came out when it did. So let me start to get through this. I've got, see if I can get rid of that. Yeah, okay, all right. I hate so many ads on all these pages. It's hard to kind of navigate your way through. It says bureaucracy has few fans. Walmart CEO Doug McMillon calls it a villain. Berkshire Hathaway Vice Chair Charlie Munger. Berkshire Hathaway, that's the company that, who's that rich guy? Warren Buffett. That's his company, Berkshire Hathaway. Right. Berkshire Hathaway Vice Chair Charlie Munger says its tentacles should be treated like the cancers they so much resemble. Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, agrees that bureaucracy is a disease. These leaders understand that bureaucracy saps initiative, inhibits risk-taking, and crushes creativity. It's a tax on human achievement. Given that, why would we model our government on it? To me, just, you know, we're stepping into the irrational here. And Gene, if I cut out any time, please let me know, because some of these are these are pretty key sentences. And it's just, and for folks that are wondering why we do this, you know, watch our voice so carefully. It's not perfect technology. You know, we're broadcasting through computers on the internet. I don't have I'm going to talk to the engineers about setting up monitor, about gauges, so I know exactly what, you know, how much power I'm putting out and all that kind of stuff. We don't have that yet, but it's a computer. We'll work on it. All right, next paragraph here. Though mindful of its evils, many people believe bureaucracy is unavoidable. Dimon remembers an outside advisor who defended it as the necessary outcome of complex businesses operating in complex international and regulatory environments. Indeed, since 1983, the number of managers, supervisors, and administrators in the U.S. workforce has grown by more than 100%, while the number of people in all other occupations has increased by just 44%. In a survey by Harvard Business Review, nearly two-thirds of respondents said their organizations had become more bureaucratic in recent years. Peter Drucker's prediction that today's organizations would have half as many layers and one-third as many managers as their late 1980s counterparts was woefully off the mark. In fact, it's just the opposite. Bureaucracy has been thriving. So we don't I think a lot of times when I think of bureaucracy, it usually is a government agency that comes to mind, and it's sort of like an unavoidable evil. It's like, well, we have to pay taxes, otherwise the government can't function, you know, and you know, we can talk about that too. But the point is that people don't think of corporations as bureaucracies, but they really are. You know, and if you've ever worked for the larger company you work for, remember the I don't even know if it's still, is Dilbert still out there, the comic Dilbert?
I think so, but I haven't paid attention to the comics in quite a long time.
It's because we don't read newspapers anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, the internet has saved the forests of the world, because the New York Times used to take several acres of trees for their Sunday edition, just to let you know. So if you want to save a tree, read your news online. And that's something we should look into also, is the amount of trees that have been saved because we don't print newspapers anymore. So that's a good thing. The bad thing is we don't get our comics. You know, I used to love the Sunday, the San Francisco Chronicle put out a great paper when I was in the city. You know, I'd have my coffee and I had this huge mug, and, you know, and I'd go through the pink section, which was the entertainment and the comics, and I read the international and the foreign stuff. It was really fun. I mean, I actually read a Sunday paper. So it was really great. We don't have that. We sort of lost that tradition. As Sundays, you know, everything's online. So, I mean, you can still read it, but it's not the same as actually having a physical paper in your hands. But quite honestly, I'd rather save the trees, you know, if I had my druthers. But, Gene, if you work in, you know, I'm sure you have this kind of like a rhetorical question, but corporations that had meetings and bosses and you know, things that, well, we can't do that. We don't do that here. That's a great idea, but, you know, and then the boss steals your idea and fires you. At least that's what happens to me, because I have a lot of ideas. I can't tell you how many times I've been fired, you know, and then my idea is taken by the person that fired me, because managers as a collective group are not the most intelligent people. Some of the upper folks are, so they know what they're doing. But generally, have you run up against a lot of corporate bureaucracies in your life and experience?
Oh, yeah. I mean, healthcare is a bureaucracy.
Okay.
Yeah.
What kind of excuses do they give you, you know, if you have a new idea, if you have an innovation, if you find a better way to do something, you know, what kind of things have they told you? I'm just curious. Anything come to mind?
Well, the big thing is if it doesn't cost them any money, they don't mind. But when money is involved, that's another whole story. But also, it doesn't even have to be the higher-ups. I had someone, this has been years ago, that she only had a couple years experience, maybe a year and a half, not much. And because she didn't know something, she let fear take over. Instead of doing what's best, she, let the fear take over. And I think that's very sad. It's like, just because you may not know something, someone else may know something. And what doesn't work for one person may work for someone else. And the thing is, I always tell people that, you know, if you keep doing the same thing, regardless if you have something great now, someone else, some other organization, something's going to come along and they're going to do something different. And then that's going to be the thing of the day. We can't stay stagnant in what we do, because unfortunately for some people who don't like change and have difficulty with change, change is a part of life. And so if we aren't willing to change, we're going to get left behind. And that means, you know, bureaucracies and everything. But what I liked about the articles is it's so true that how they think is so obsolete. And it just takes one, one organization to really start the ball rolling. You know, like they said, like, you know, good people, their customer service, and, you know, they gave Apple as one. I'm like, Apple doesn't have the greatest customer service. They did fill a need with computers, and heck yeah. But it's like, and the reason I say they don't have real good customer service is you have to wait God knows how long. I mean, sometimes you have to wait days to get an appointment. And I know that's just unfortunately the time now. Because I can't tell you how many places are closing because they can't find help, how many places have cut down their hours because they can't find help. And so we're living in interesting times, but I think too, we need to be open and it's like do things different, because I think that's where the real change is going to be.
Well, you said a couple of interesting things. Actually, a lot of interesting things. Let me see if I can just focus on a couple of them here. One of them is Apple. I got to tell you a funny story about Apple. When I lived out in the San Francisco Bay Area, after my flight instruction kind of ended because the market dropped, the airlines went broke. This is the early 90s. And I was thinking, I better find something else to do here because, you know, flying's not going anywhere. I started writing articles, and I ended up writing a book. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction, which is still out there selling, which is interesting. It's going to sell a whole lot more when we get our first million listeners. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. But I took my book and I went to Apple. And this is back when Apple was six buildings. So it really wasn't a huge, you know, deal yet. And I said, you know, I'm having real trouble with your computer manuals. I had one of the I think it was a Mac Classic. It was one of the very first ones, you know, black and white TV screen things. And they used it for word processing. That's how I wrote my book, right? And so I went to them. I said, you know what? I'm learning how to use this by trial and error. I said, your instruction manuals, quite frankly, suck. I didn't say that, but that's what I'm thinking to myself, right? I said, I find it very difficult. And I think the reason is, and I said, I based on my flight instruction. I said, the reason is, you know, it's like trying to get directions from someone that knows exactly where they're going to someone who doesn't. And if you get directions from someone who knows, they say, well, you go down by the old oak tree, you turn left at Bob's Farm, you turn right at the, Mabel's Donut Shop. Okay. And that's great if you happen to know where Bob's Farm, Maple's Donut Shop, and the Old Oak Tree are. But if you don't know, you want to give definite directions. You go 1.5 miles to Smith Street, turn left on Wright Road, and then you turn right on, you know, give directions that help somebody understand. So what I tried to explain to these folks, I said that your computer manuals are written by technical experts who know all the words, but we don't. I said, would you be willing to let me have a chance to write a manual, you know, for non-computer people? And I think it would, and here's my book, and here's how I explain very technical things in aviation, you know, complex concepts of lift and drag and lift coefficients and, you know, all the different things, you know, power loading, wing loading, things like that. And I make them very simple. All right. I said, would you be interested in this talent for writing computer manuals so anybody could understand them, even if you didn't know anything about computers? Guess what their answer was?
No.
No, of course it was. Because they already had their bureaucracy. They already had their insulated group. They already had their people that knew everything. And not to say they aren't a great company and a huge company. Obviously, they've gotten along with my help. But quite frankly, their manuals still suck. I can't use them.
Right.
To this day. I can't. And, and it's not just Apple. I mean, I look at any computer product. Because they're written by people that know so much, they assume that you know the same thing. And this is why you'll always see me when guests come on, especially if they say a lot of acronyms. You know, that they know, or like military people, you know, we've got the FSG operation. Well, what's that? Well, you don't know? No, I don't. you know, whatever it happens, there was no FSG operation. I just made that up. But that's the point. But you can bring this to a personal level. You know, we've all been affected by bureaucracy in both corporations and government. Try getting a response from government. But the thing is, people just complain about it. And of course, that's not the function of Action Radio. The function of Action Radio is to fix it. And find a way to fix it, and then have you folks, you know, tell everybody else how to fix it, you know, based on the legislation that we come up with here. All right, so this is where it gets more interesting. So back to our article here. It says, meanwhile, productivity has stalled. So bureaucracy has increased 100%. Productivity has stalled. I bet you will find that there's a direct correlation between the growth of bureaucracy and the reduction of productivity. Because bureaucracy is not made for productivity. It's made for keeping things as they are. And as you said earlier, and it's an excellent point, change is going to happen anyway. Change is happening to radio. We are going to change radio. We are. The internet changed radio. It became worldwide. You didn't have to have a broadcast station pumping out more power. You know, you don't reach more people by more power. You reach more people by sharing on social media. You know, so the world has already changed. We're using social media in ways that have never been done before to actually lobby legislation. Okay? So we're changing things all the time here. We're changing things so fast, I have trouble keeping up. It's like, what's the innovation, you know, today? This one with going after bureaucracies is yet another innovation of Action Radio. We're breaking new ground again, you know. And so, you know, at some point, regular radio is going to be faced with a choice. They're either going to have to keep talk radio and see if that works for them, or they're going to try Action Radio. And when they try Action Radio, Gene, you and I are going to laugh our butts off because it's really going to be funny to see how these bureaucrats try and do who have no, I think, ability to take new ideas. You look at drive time radio. It hasn't changed since the 60s. You know, news, weather, sports, you know, that kind of stuff is designed for AM radio. It's designed for that 20-minute commute which is about what people took in the 1960s. 20, 25 minutes was how long it took to get to work, not an hour and a half like it does today, right? So they compressed everything to 20, 25 minutes because that was the formula in 1960. So you hop in your 1968 Impala, you turn on your AM radio, you go down the freeway that's not that crowded yet, and you go to work. And you get everything you need, news, sports, and weather in your 20 minutes. That doesn't exist anymore. That's gone, folks. And yet they're still on that model. So I'm curious to see how radio reacts to us as we grow. And we will. And we're going to grow very fast this year, I have a feeling. So but it should be interesting to see. We got Pianki in the line. I'm going to get him right on the line now, too. And we'll talk about Pianki's bureaucracies and corporate and government experience. And what do you think so far, sir? Good morning.
Good morning, you and Gene.
Sound
like you're still full of turkey.
We are
you're
perky.
Still full of turkey.
Oh, yeah. Oh, full of turkey.
Hey, look,
I thought you said perky.
Turkey.
Okay. My animal noises.
The word that you're looking for to describe is there's no stopping an idea whose time has come.
Ooh, who said
very
that?
Very true.
Is that a Pianki original?
Yeah. Well,
I like that.
Of.
Yeah.
But,
well,
yes, the change, bureaucracies like to stymie change. They like to keep things as they have been, whose data shows that they're really not obtaining what they were sold to be. And they actually are nothing more than an impediment to progress.
Yeah.
So
well, that's,
you may yeah, mention right. you may mm-hmm. mention that even people who don't have children in schools should be mm-hmm. afforded vouchers so that they can donate them
mm-hmm.
to the institution of their choice.
Mm-hmm.
In many
yeah, I kinda
cases,
like that idea.
In many cases, that would help alleviate the fact that people don't give endowments to schools for a host of reasons, but of all those reasons, what you just mentioned would help alleviate at least one or two.
And the best schools would rise and people would, we always talk about, or I think it was Jefferson or someone that said that taxation without representation is tyranny. So if you're taxing people for education and they can't, it's not the same thing. I mean, but if they can't spend, you know, if they don't have the same option to spend money because of a condition, yet they're being taxed for something, you know, that to me is without representation in the fact that they can't spend the tax money that someone else can spend because they have kids. So, and people when the kids have grown will be another instance. You know, people with grandkids should be able to take vouchers, you know, and donate it to whatever cause they want. And, of course, you know, wealthier folks are free to donate anytime they want, so we're not going to stop them. Let me get back to this article. This is a good point. I mean, it's an excellent point on schools, and that's a whole other bureaucracy. We'll talk about that. But I find this article fascinating. It says, meanwhile, productivity growth has stalled. From 1948 to 2004, U.S. labor productivity among non-financial firms grew by an average of 2.5%. Okay, that sucks, folks, especially with inflation at like 3%. Since then, its growth has averaged just 1.1%. That's no coincidence. Bureaucracy is particularly virulent in large companies, which have come to dominate the U.S. economy. More than a third of the U.S. labor force now works in firms with more than 5,000 employees, where those on the front lines are buried under 8 levels of management on average. That's staggering. Want to hear more? Let me give you more. Feel free to comment anytime. Just interrupt me, and I'll stop here. The next paragraph. Some look to startups as an antidote, but although firms such as Uber, Airbnb, Farfetch, and Didi Chengxing get a lot of press, this is back in 2018, obviously, these and other unicorns account for a small fraction of their respective economies. And as entrepreneurial ventures scale up, they fall victim to bureaucracy themselves. One fast-growing IT vendor managed to accumulate 600 vice presidents on its way to reaching $4 billion in annual sales. What the hell do you do with 600 vice presidents? Anyway, it says, why is bureaucracy so resistant to efforts to kill it? In part, because it works, at least to a degree. Yeah, I'm going to question that. Anyway, with its clear lines of authority, specialized units, and standardized bureaucracy facilitates efficiency at scale. It's also comfortably familiar, varying little across industries, cultures, and political systems. Now, to me, that sounds like a formula for dictatorship. Whether it's corporate or government, it's still a dictatorship. That does not sound like a virtue to me. It sounds like actually the reason not to have it. Pianki, Gene? You just want to get on this?
Well, it's true about the layers and layers of bureaucracy. When you made mention of the number of vice presidents that some company mm-hmm. has. And take, for instance, OSHA, what they're trying to do with it, that mm-hmm. it was never said it would be, nor mm-hmm. has it been until these ideas came along.
Well, here's the thing, too, about OSHA. What is it about a bureaucracy that is willing to take on something willingly until it was stopped by the Fifth Circuit Court? They're perfectly willing to take on something that they're not legally allowed to do, without question, and then we're just going to take it on and say, okay, yeah, we'll do that. You know, what kind of people, what kind of power-hungry, mad fascists are OSHA that they're willing to take on something instead of saying, I'm sorry, that's not in our authority. We can't do that. That's what they should have said, but they didn't do it because this would have given them more power. And what this article is not talking about yet is that bureaucracy's main goal is to increase power and control. And that's what makes them so dangerous, I think.
Well, like the U.S. Department of Education
mm-hmm.
is no longer needed. Really, OSHA is no longer needed because companies themselves can create those departments of safety that mm-hmm. specialize in what those companies are involved in and are exposed to.
Well, as long as there's decent lawsuits and decent courts that allow for those lawsuits. So you don't need environmental laws either. If companies can be sued for breaking laws and damaging the environment in completely unnecessary and dangerous ways. I mean, there are ways to do it. But until that happens, you know, companies violate work rules all the time. You know, especially, this is why I think a lot of truckers are independent, because they can set their own hours. But you work for a company. Company says, you know, we need you to work a couple of hours overtime. Well, I can't. The government says that, you know, I can only work 10 hours a day and I need my required rest, which they do. The Department of Transportation has commercial truck guidelines. The company says, well, yeah, we know, but we really need this shipment done. And if you won't do it, we'll just find somebody else. Okay. See, that kind of thing goes on all the time. All right. So they want the drivers to risk the rules. And then if the driver breaks the rules and gets arrested for it, they get pulled over by the state police in whatever state they're in. And they find that they've exceeded their rest hours. It's the driver that gets punished, not the company. The driver can say, well, the company made me do it. Well, let's see. Hey, you're the one driving the truck, pal. You know, it's your fault. You know, so
and the company's not going to say, oh, yeah, we made them do it. They're going to lie.
Of course they are.
Well, that's why your insurance companies come in place. Anyone mm-hmm. that's operating vehicles on the road has to have liability insurance. And it's up to insurance companies to make sure that the companies have written policies that apply to the examples that you gave. And if they don't, well, that notation should be made. Then it puts the company open for liability suits.
Yes, that's it. They have to have liability. See, I'm a firm believer in unions, private unions, and good unions that actually, you know, would have good safety and work rules so that the driver of that truck for company X could say, look, they tried to make me work overtime. They call the union. Union calls the company and say, look, you can't do that. You know, and we represent all your workers. And we're going to have a problem if you keep trying to make people break the law. That's where a union could come in, or decent lawyers, or decent advocacy groups. You know, there are ways to do this. It doesn't always have to be a bureaucracy. That's the point I'm getting to. So let me get the next paragraph here. Despite this huge increasing bureaucracy that the article talked about earlier, bureaucracy is not inevitable. Since the term was coined roughly two centuries ago, much has changed. Today's employees are skilled, not illiterate. Competitive advantage comes from innovation, not sheer size. Communication is instantaneous, not torturous, and the pace of change is hypersonic, not glacial. And again, I'll use the example of action radio. Here we have an entirely new radio genre. We are evolving beyond talk radio. We actually have combined a citizen legislature. We've devised a way for people to become their own citizen legislators. It's decentralized. I'm not telling anybody what to do. So I want to talk about the bureaucracy of action radio here in a second. But when you look at this, you know, let's talk about it now. Anybody's free to take any bill that we have posted on Write Your Laws and do anything they want with it. They can share it. They can comment on it. They can send it to legislators. They can bring it up on talk shows. They can just read it and go, well, that's interesting. You know, there's no, we're probably the most decentralized station at all. All my reporters, Gene, my producer, I don't tell anybody what to say at all. And a lot of stations do that. A lot of talk radio does that too. I don't pre-approve stories. You know, folks can bring what they want to it. You know, and we don't cut people off after 2 minutes. Pianki calls the show two or three times sometimes, you know, whenever there's something of interest to him. And that's fine with me. So I'm trying to make this, you know, as unbureaucratic as we can to allow the maximum freedom for the most people to express themselves in the greatest ways possible and to be innovative and be bold and not hold back. And if I'm ever not doing that, I'm counting on you folks to let me know. But anyway, that's the model I'm trying to create here, is a very decentralized, very innovative, very individual-centered, where people are free to try things, and then you're free to be wrong. You're free to screw up. You're free to, you know, bring up a really boring topic that you might not bring up again. But at least you have the chance to try it, because every once in a while, something you think might not be great turns out to be immensely important, and that's when the magic happens. So how are we doing on bureaucracy, folks? Any improvements, anything I can do better? Ooh, really,
we got her walking out the door already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, Bianchi. Okay, let me keep going then, because this is we haven't gotten to the Chinese company that really is the basis of what I wanted to talk about. Okay, so we know innovation is good, and we know that it doesn't come from bureaucracy. It's like bureaucracy is the anathema to innovation. Our article says these new realities are at last producing alternatives to bureaucracy. Perhaps the most promising model can be found at a company that would not, at first glance, appear to be a child of the digital age. Hiier, that's Haier, based in Qingdao, China, or Qingdao, I don't know how you pronounce it, Qingdao, Qingdao, China, is currently the world's largest appliance maker. Not Whirlpool, not GE, Hiier, okay, in Qingdao, China. This is with revenues of $35 billion. It competes with household names such as, here we go, Whirlpool, LG, and Electrolux. At present, Hiier has some 75,000 employees globally. Outside China, it has 27,000 employees, many of whom joined the company when it bought GE's appliance business in 2016. Did you know that GE's appliance business was owned by Hiier in China? I didn't.
I never even heard of it before.
Yeah, neither had I until I read this article. All right? This is the fun of discovery. I'll continue on here. Over the past decade, the gross profits of Hiier's core appliance business has grown by 23% a year. Well, that's a hell of a lot bigger than the bureaucratic companies at 1%, right? While revenue has increased by 18% annually, the company has also created more than $2 billion in market value from new ventures. Those feats are unmatched by any of Hiier's domestic or global competitors. This remarkable journey hasn't been entirely pain-free. In recent years, Hiier dismissed more than 10,000 employees. Yet it has also generated tens of thousands of new jobs in its rapidly expanding ecosystem. I would guess that those 10,000 employees did things that didn't need to be done. Okay, that would be my guess, and that they were buggy whip makers and they didn't want to change to make whatever the next thing was. They weren't adaptable. That would be my guess. Anyway, Hiier's logistics network, which stretches across China, now includes more than 90,000 independent drivers, for instance. Okay, 90,000 drivers.
Wow.
Whoa. This is a big company, okay? Now, here's where it starts to get interesting, all right? Here's a little subheading. Micro-enterprises are free to form and evolve with little central direction, okay? This is the secret. This is the secret of this company. Micro-enterprises, most of their operations through China have no more than, I think, 20 people. Well, I said it's 10 to 15, if I remember. I'm starting to make a model for government where no government agency could be more than 20, no government office could be more than 20 people. Anyway, so think about that. Just imagine micro enterprises. In other words, thousands, literally thousands of independent operations, all innovating all across China, all loosely connected to the Hiier appliance company. That's my model for government. Is independent offices all throughout all the states, you know, and no offices in Washington, none. Maybe a cabinet secretary, but that's it. But there would be no bureaucracies in Washington. There would all be small offices scattered across the country and represented to the people. I mean, you could go knock on the door. You want to go knock on the IRS door? Well, they'd be there. You want to go knock on the Department of Education door? Well, probably a little bit of a drive, you know, maybe 20 miles. But in other words, enough offices around the country that every person in this country could knock on the door of a federal office, a federal bureaucracy, and get some kind of response. That's my goal.
Well, here's another thing. GE Appliances, if GE Appliances was ever licensed by the federal government with an employer identification number, then there should be certain things that go along with that. Like, for instance, you cannot sell to a foreign country because it brings up a national security issue. If we had the ability to hire
refrigerators here. Yeah.
And also the fact that you are putting a lot of Americans out of work. And that does become a national security issue because of all the social programs that has to be developed and the cost of them in order to continue to make that person a viable person. So selling off to foreign countries, it should not be allowed.
How are you talking about companies shouldn't be sold? Yeah, oh, so okay, I was wondering where you're getting to. So you're saying GE should not have sold their appliance division to Haier in China. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. Should not.
Okay. I think that's a bit of a separate issue, but it's certainly an important one. But I don't know how that affects the bureaucracy. See, and that's a really good question. I mean, what industries are vital to our national interests? But here's the problem, though. Look at the public utilities. If you government protect an industry saying they can't be sold to other countries, you know, then they want to guarantee profit. They want regulation. It's like Facebook sending fake whistleblowers into Congress so that Congress would regulate them because they know that once Congress regulates, that's guaranteed profit. You know, same thing with public utilities. You know, when we used to have private, you know, power companies generating power, and we used to have in San Francisco, I think there were at one point, you know, 30 cable car companies before the city took them over. You know, and so they would have these were private corporations. They might just have one line. You know, they go up the hill and down
well,
the hill.
It doesn't
with their cable
necessarily.
Cars. Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily guarantee profits because it's not saying that you cannot have competition. There's acts that prevent that type of monopoly. But the thing is, when you when you send jobs abroad, you in fact do help create more bureaucracy because now you got to have some sort of welfare program, some type of assistance program that's usually headed by these bureaucratic offices.
Yeah, I mean, I understand retraining. If the GE's, you know, appliance division moves to China, I don't know if they still make them here or not. That'd be something to look into. But I want to get back to the chairman of Haier because what I want to get to is a model. You know, and the next section is from monolithic business to micro enterprises because I think the secret to government is decentralization to micro offices. And that's kind of where I'm going with this right now. So let me go to this next section and see what you think. Haier success is the result of root and branch overhaul of its once traditional management model. Having long viewed bureaucracy as a competitive liability, Zhang Ruimin, Haier's renegade CEO, I like the fact that Harvard calls him a renegade CEO, and now I'm impressed already, has for a decade led an effort to build a company where everyone is directly accountable to customers, which is a policy he describes as zero distance. Employees are energetic entrepreneurs, and an open ecosystem of users, inventors, and partners replaces formal hierarchy. Now, I think that's not only a model for business, I think that's a model for government, and yet it's never been applied that way. What if there was zero distance between government workers, you know, and officers and the public? Okay, I'm not talking about the DMV. Even that has distance to it in the responsiveness, but at least they have different offices. You don't have to go to one central office in the state capital, for example. But what if the government employees were rewarded for being entrepreneurs within a government system, that salaries were based on creativity and innovation and not civil service? So part of my plan would be to abolish civil service and abolish all the whatever the equivalent of tenure is that these people have. But this is where I'm going with this. One last paragraph here. Haier shorthand for these practices is Rendan Haiyai, a mashup of Chinese characters that connotes a tight coupling of the value created for customers with the value received by employees. The Rendan Haiyai model departs from bureaucratic norms in seven critical ways, which we'll look at in depth in this article. And that's what I was going to do for the next hour, is to kind of go through some of these and see what you think. So here's the big question that may not be able to be answered now, but can government be decentralized enough to be like a responsive corporation and still carry on the functions of government?
Well, if you limit their functions, for instance, let me give you another example.
Okay.
We got a civil rights division. Well, now when you create an Asian hate crime bill, now you got to have a division to monitor that. Then you have a discrimination against women bill. Now you got to have a division, which is bureaucratic, to monitor and carry out that. Whereas all you need is just a civil right. All American civil citizens have civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you need.
You know, it'd be worth going into the civil rights legislation, because as they keep adding protected groups, and I thought of adding gun owners and ideology as a protected group. In other words, you couldn't go after someone because they were conservative. And so a bunch of things like that. I think you're on the right track. I think we need to, civil rights to be, the Civil Rights Act is something we need to go over and see if we can improve that as well. All right, let's take a break for a little bit. I'm going to play our Santa Rosa Volunteers piece on, once again, Federalist Papers number 7. And I'll be probably making a new one today on the Anti-Federalist number 7. And so we'll be back in a few minutes. Hope you enjoy this. And then we'll get back to here's my article here. What do they call it? We've got 7 critical ways to decentralize corporations. And the question then is, can we apply those to government? And I'll be back in a bit. There's the button. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. In Federalist Paper number 7, Alexander Hamilton once again beats the same dead horse he trotted out in his first Federalist Paper, that the Constitution has to be ratified or the states will end up divided in 3 or so groups or will cause other nations to invade us. Upping the ante now, he claims that we will all be at war with ourselves in this paper, and once again the cure is to ratify the Constitution. Ironic again that the Constitution was in full force when the states did divide, but in a unified way against the federal government created by the Constitution, and not in the 3 or 4 separate confederacies as argued by Hamilton and the Federalists, but one confederacy of states who were run by the Democrat Party. Be careful what you wish for. Hamilton begins with this question. It is sometimes asked, with an air of seeming triumph, what inducements could the states have, if disunited, to make war upon each other? This is a preposterous question, given that the states were united under the Articles of the Confederacy, and that no states were at war or were, to my knowledge, trying to take each other's territory. So Hamilton asks a question that requires an assumption that doesn't exist. Therefore, a legitimate answer cannot be given. But that's not the point of the question. The point is to plant in your brain that if the states became disunited, what would save the Union? And the only answer Hamilton wants you to consider is the new Constitution. Hamilton also says, we have a vast tract of unsettled territory within the boundaries of the United States. There are still discordant and undecided claims between several of them, and the dissolution of the Union would lay a foundation for similar claims between them all. Well, yes, the dissolution of the Union would cause territorial disputes, but to use that as a reason to ratify the Constitution, you have to believe 2 things. One, that there is going to be a dissolution of the Union under the Articles of Confederation, and 2, that there will be no dissolution of the Union nor any territorial disputes if the Constitution is ratified. Both of those are impossible to argue as connected or even probable individually. Therefore, the argument for the Constitution from the Federalists is based solely on their fertile imagination of what they think will scare the people who would vote to ratify the Constitution the most. If this is in fact the case, then the Constitution was argued from a huge pyramid of ever-increasing lies designed to channel all thinking to a predetermined outcome without real examination, because the building block evidence and arguments of the Federalists crumble at the slightest scrutiny. They knew that, but argued it that way anyway. Kind of sounds like the government position on COVID since early 2020. Hamilton concludes, from the view they have exhibited of this part of the subject, this conclusion is to be drawn, that America, if not connected at all, or only by the feeble tie of a simple league, offensive and defensive, would, by the operation of such jarring alliances, be gradually entangled in all the pernicious labyrinths of European politics and wars, and by the destructive contentions of the parts into which she was divided, would be likely to become a prey to the artifices and machinations of powers equally the enemies of all of them. Divide and conquer must be the motto of every nation that either hates or fears us. At the end of this Federalist paper, Alexander Hamilton has tied together every preposterous proposition he is making with the hope that enough bogus fears will be grouped together, and the simple weight of numbers of so many ridiculous assumptions will somehow, as a group, give them credibility. Divide and conquer. I wonder if he would have used race like it's used today, if he could. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with a personal recommendation and testimonial for Eric Colley, our new webmaster and marketing guru. Eric has been invaluable in upgrading our website, writeyourlaws.com. To help you with your marketing, Eric Colley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. Most business owners don't have the time or expertise to excel at marketing. Even fewer have the funds to hire a special employee. And you don't have to. There is a better option. Eric Colley, a consultant who uses leading-edge marketing strategies to increase your profitability at costs which are far more affordable than an advertising or marketing agency. You can be seen high up in Google's Page One. You can dominate Google's local three-pack of businesses next to the search results map. You can increase foot and website traffic. Eric Colley can be reached at 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. His website is besmallbusiness.com, besmallbusiness. And you can reach him by email at eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's how you do it.
Action Radio, dedicated to fixing everything.
Okay, we're back, and just a quick note, Eric Colley is the one who's rebuilding our website, writeyourlaws.com. It's going to be, oh, it already is fabulous, but I've also been working on it myself. I had to reformat about all 80 of our bills that are on there right now, and so to get them ready for the new site. So it's going to be fabulous, and we're going to be hopefully, next thing to do is to contact CPAC again and see if I can get to teach some citizen legislative workshops this year, and that's going to help out. So we're all going to CPAC. It's in Orlando the last week in February, and so as many people of Action Radio as can be there, hopefully, because I want you guys to all meet each other. Bianchi, you should come too. I think you'd have a blast. Come on down. You're one of the family, so it would be great to have you there as well, and just because it would be fun to chat airplanes and stuff. Oh, there's some really cool airplanes coming out, just to totally change the subject here. These light sport airplanes, these European ones, they have these Rotax 915 turbo engines, and the things do over 200 miles an hour, and they only weigh like 800 pounds. These tiny little two-seat airplanes, they're all composite, and Rotax, of course, takes car gas, so they're cheap to operate. They cost about $200,000 to buy one, where, you know, it's a fairly steep price, but to operate them is like nothing compared to a lot of airplanes, which may cost $50,000 or $60,000, some of the older ones, but can cost you a fortune just to keep them in the air. We're gonna do an air show at some point here. That might be kind of fun. Anyway, so website's coming out. It's everything's been changed over, reformatted, and so we have some just amazing things happening here. Anyway, let's get our folks back on. We got Gina, producer, and Bianchi, caller, citizen legislator. Gene, we got to get you writing something too at some point. We'll get you in the bill writing mood, because it's kind of, you got to do something with healthcare. Well, you know, there's so many things to do. Maybe ending bureaucracy somehow. All right. So I started this article here a little bit ago. It's called "The End of Bureaucracy." It's from the Harvard Business Review by Gary Hamel and Michelle Zanini from December of 2018. If anybody wants to look it up, Pianki, did you have a comment before we get started here? And then I'll ask Gene too the same thing. Anything so far?
On with the show.
Okay, sounds good to me. And Jean, of course, you can jump in anytime. And Jean has the hotel bell, so she gets to interrupt me with the nice little room service thing. So you'll probably hear that at some point today, too. Excuse me. Ah, wintertime scratchy throat. The next section, from monolithic businesses to microenterprises. And this is what really inspired me to sort of translate this to my bill, the Department of Innovation, is to use this as a model, but transfer it to government. And I think it can be done in a somewhat efficient way. You know, you actually look at the DMV, it's kind of a model for that. They're just not as responsive as we want them to be. So that's more of a policy change. But the idea that they have offices all over the state is actually a pretty good idea. All right, so this article says, large corporations often consist of a few dominant businesses, each with its own orthodoxy about strategy, customers, and technology. These tightly integrated entities and their monocultures make a company vulnerable to unconventional competitors and blinded to new kinds of opportunities. Of course, that would be Action Radio trying to, you know, when I initially tried to join some of these big radio networks, like, Salem and what are some of the other big ones? iHeart, Cumulus, those kind of folks. Guess what they said? No. Okay, anyway, so that's another story too. Anyway. So to avoid that risk, Hire, this is the Chinese company we were talking about earlier, has divided itself into more than 4,000 micro-enterprises. Let me say that again, 1,000 micro-enterprises, or MEs, most of which have 10 to 15 employees. To be sure, some MEs, particularly in manufacturing, have larger payrolls, but even in them, decisions are made by small, autonomous teams. And so I'm looking at this going, you know, this is a pretty good idea. Can we do that for government? So break up the Department of Education, the EPA, OSHA, and you might want to get rid of these departments, and that's a viable argument too. But our bureaucracies, you know, the Pentagon, would that be interesting? Could military stuff be decentralized across the country to have, have offices in the bases where people could go and, you know, come in and military stuff? I don't know. I'm just exploring ideas here. But anyway, could government operate with micro enterprises as opposed to huge bureaucracies in Washington? And I think decidedly yes is the answer to that. Okay. So the other thing I was reminded of, there was, I think it was Volvo or Saab. It's one of the Swedish or Norwegian auto companies. And here's the evolution of the assembly line. The assembly line actually started in the meatpacking industry. I think it was back in the late 1800s, where they found in Chicago that if you send, you know, a side of beef or a whole cow, you know, or a steer down the line, and each butcher trims off the same part and then goes to the next plate and they take off the same part, you know, it was like a de-assembly line. And so that's how they basically take apart, you know, a steer for you know, package and off it goes. And so Henry Ford looked at this and went, well, that's interesting. What if we do it the other way? You know, what if we reverse the process and use it instead of a de-assembly line, an assembly line? And of course, that's how the assembly line was born. So Henry Ford came up with this idea of making cars, where instead of having workers build a car, each worker would do the same job over and over and over and over again, repetitive to the point of you know, I guess insanity. Anyway, but that's how it works. So that's an assembly line. You know, each worker does one particular function. The car goes down the line. All right. So these teams, in I think for Volvo or Saab, one of those companies, Gene, if you're interested, you might be able to find something on this. They talked about how they used to have small teams, and six people would build a car. And they would take it through they would follow the car through the different operations, and then you had to do them all. And they found it was very interesting. And they'd take their car and they, you know, and it was all basically, or they would have, you know, a lot of operations would be done by a small team, and then the car would go to another, you know, small team that would do a whole bunch of things to it. So the job was interesting. And from that, they found innovation. They found different ways of doing things. And it became a model that I thought made a whole lot of sense. The other source of this, I think it was Peters, 100 Best Corporations in America to Work For, or In Search of Excellence. And there's another guy. There are two books that came out in the 80s, In Search of Excellence and the 100 Best Companies in America to Work For. And all these companies had one thing in common, decentralized bureaucracy. They were, I think Gore, that does Gore-Tex, is, I remember reading a paragraph on Gore-Tex. And you go into Gore-Tex, and you don't have to have a job in mind. You don't have to apply for a specific position. You don't have to have a ton of experience. You just have to be capable and imaginative. And they said, why don't you get, you know, hang out here for a month and see what you're best at doing. And that's how they used to hire people. And I thought, damn, I want to work for them if I didn't have other things, other plans. But that's the kind of company I could work for because I'd find imaginative things to do and I'd find where my best talents lie. And so Gore is the Gore Corporation is the perfect model of this decentralized, you know, do the best you can, you know, and these Swedish car companies or Norwegian, you know, Volvo or Saab, you know, small teams that talk to each other and cooperate. It's just a much better model of efficiency and productivity and imagination and creativity and innovation. That's what drives a company. Companies are driven by innovation and creativity. I don't care what anybody says. All right. So large corporations often consist, I think I read that part too. Okay, right. Next paragraph. Micro enterprises come in three variables. First, there are roughly 200 transforming micro enterprises, market-facing units that have roots in Haier's legacy appliance business, but are reinventing themselves for today's customer-centric web-enabled world. Xinxing, which makes refrigerators for young urban customers, is a typical example. Well, that's interesting. Second, there are 50-plus incubating micro enterprises or entirely new businesses. Some like Thunder Robot are focused on emerging markets such as e-gaming, while others like Xinyu, a smart refrigerator that connects users with third-party services that sell fresh food and deliver it within 30 minutes, are wrapping new business models around familiar products. Now, I never heard that before. Think about that. Your refrigerator, your refrigerator can contact a supplier. The stuff shows up and you toss it in your refrigerator for dinner. What is that, like just-in-time you know, factory work? I find that fascinating.
Yeah, that technology exists.
Yeah,
you can
okay.
tie, you know, every storage place in your home that stores something digitally can communicate to your grocery basket when you go shopping. So you have a screen and the status of your supplies at the house, whether you short on butter or whether you short on flour or whatever, it'll show up on the screen so that you know what to shop for.
Oh, that's a hoot. That's a great idea. I mean, I sometimes I write down a list, but sometimes I just go hungry with lots of money because it's much more interesting to see what I come home with. But that's my spontaneous nature. But yeah, that's fascinating. So the idea that you can check your refrigerator to see what's there in the market, instead of calling up your sweetie and say, honey, can you tell me what's in the refrigerator? I mean, I see people on the phones all the time in supermarkets. I mean, now I know what they're doing. It's kind of funny. All right. Anyway, so, yeah, this is fascinating.
Yeah,
so
that idea, it comes from artificial intelligence applies to inventory. So every time you take – it's already in existence, in fact. When you go to a bin and take out a piece, then it's recorded that you are short one piece, short two piece, short three piece for that particular bin number. Well, the same thing can be applied to your home also, with your cabinets and your refrigerator and so on and so on, your drawers and so on and so on.
Yeah, then people hack into it and use it for advertising and they see what you have in your refrigerator. Yeah, there's a downside to this too. We have to have some security. But yeah, that's fascinating. Anyway, he says that there are roughly 3,800 Node, micro enterprises, and these businesses sell components and product and services such as design, manufacturing, and human resource support to Haier's market-facing micro enterprises. Micro enterprises are key to Zhang's goal of building the world's first company for the internet age. That entails more than developing web-enabled products, like we were talking about a minute ago. It means creating an organizational model that mimics the architecture of the internet, small pieces loosely joined. As Harvard technologist David Weinberger famously put it, the web is incredibly diverse and yet still coherent. While it has spawned countless innovations, it's held together by common technical standards that make cyberspace navigable and allow sites to swap resources like data. So there you go. So in other words, it works for this company. It's a large company. It's as large as any number of government bureaucracies. Why couldn't government decentralize into micro enterprises or micro offices across the country so that anybody could talk to the office, you know, whatever they wanted to, of a particular thing? I mean, it makes sense to me.
Well, you can do that with Zoom, too. Video phones. You necessarily don't have to have an office all in every place in the country. You can have many deaths at the central location where people in Philadelphia can call and they hit their desk, plus their desk can share more than one city. So it doesn't have to be a office in every location around the country. You can have central.
Well, it's just the idea that you can knock on somebody's door. See, with Zoom, you can still have that distance. They can just cut off your Zoom. But if there are offices where you can actually go talk to a person, you know, I think it makes it much more, much harder for them to avoid the public. And so but the main thing I think is to get rid of all the Washington departments, just close them down, tear those buildings down, get rid of, well, maybe not tear them down, but do something different. Move every agency out of Washington, D.C. There should be no government agencies in Washington. That would totally change the culture, totally change everything, and would totally change who would work there too. You know, if you had education in Wyoming, if you had, you know, the EPA in Tucson, you know, I mean, just move places around and see who wants to go there. Or if you didn't have any central locations at all, if all the government was decentralized and the only centralization was the cabinet secretaries, maybe a few managers in Washington, you know, coordinating the overall big policy and then the smaller policies were done all at the local level. I mean, we don't know where this is going to go. It's just interesting. Anyway, go ahead.
When you talk about education, the responsibility for the direction and outcome of their child's education and their performance should be thrown back on the parents and the family, not a school teacher who has 15 or 20 students in the classroom. And then you have some students that come from those functional operating families who are usually far ahead of the rest of the classmates. Now you have stymied them down to nothing but boredom. So that needs to change.
Wait, did you see the article I posted in the Action Radio Mind Project on the danger of public schools to smart kids? It's exactly what you're talking about.
It is dangerous. You're absolutely right. And let me another thing, too. Like when we talk about selling GE to China, well, you're not just doing away with the appliance manufacturer. You're doing away with service. The service people have to have trucks. The trucks have to have maintenance, and they have to have supplies like oil, lubrication, spark plugs.
Mm-hmm.
You are doing away with more than just the manufacturer itself allowing it to go, but you're putting all these other downstream entities out of business.
See, and I don't know if GE had their own truck fleet, because I know if you go to an appliance store, the appliance store usually has their own trucks, or they contract
with
other companies.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, the appliance store. Right,
yeah.
So you have to have all these support systems that go along with what it is that the manufacturer is producing.
But that doesn't mean they stop operations here. Like I just found out Target. Now I know why people call it Target, because it's owned by a French company. So Target still operates in the United States. They haven't stopped doing anything, even though they're owned by a side company. There's a lot of companies in the United States that are owned by companies, bigger companies in foreign countries. They don't stop operations here. I don't think GE has stopped making appliances here. They just have a new
Target owner. Well, you don't have no GE appliances to service. That's what the problem comes in. GE appliances have a particular part number for a part that will be carried by an appliance parts store. Well, when you eliminate the parts that an appliance parts store carries, then you're eliminating people who have an occupation, who's paying taxes, who's supporting the school system, and on and on and on and on.
Unless another company rises to take their place.
Yeah, but is it an American company?
I don't know. We're in the theoretical world here. Well,
look at all the millionaires you've created have been created in China. When you put that type of capital in the hands of people, then they can go out and further do damage.
And there's the hotel bell. Jean, what you got?
No, I just wanted to tell you that Target is not owned by a French company.
It's not.
And the reason I know that, it started in Minnesota. The headquarters are in Minnesota. So, yeah, it's an American company.
Who owns it now? I'm just curious.
Let me see.
See,
did they sell it to the French. Let me see now if I can get it. Hold on. You can keep talking and I'll interrupt you again.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I also want to encourage people to go to our live chat, too. And so we have Gene signs into it and monitors it as well. But every once in a while I check in. We don't have anybody in live chat now. This is generally where we'll find people that object to what I'm saying. You get to type in stuff and feel free. I mean, you know, you can agree or you can disagree. I find generally the people agree call in. The people that disagree type in. And that's okay too. But anyway, live chat's open. You just need to get yourself a free account and you can find that on our broadcast page. But of course, you can only use it when we're live. So it only works when we're live. So if you're listening to the podcast, that won't be available to you. All right, let me continue on here a little bit.
Okay, hold on. It just says that Target is owned by the Target Corporation, which was previously the Dayton Hudson Corporation until 2000.
Yeah, who owns the Target Corporation, though? That's the question.
It just says the corporation. It just that's.
Oh. So why do we call it Target?
Go to Yahoo Finance, Gene. You can find out who owns everything.
Okay, let me do
good.
That.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was thinking Standard & Poor's or any of those corporate rating services, they'll know. Yeah, good point, Bianchi. All right, so the last paragraph here, and I'm going to skip this next section, is this hires model structure, modular structure, is similarly flexible but coherent. Microenterprises are free to form and evolve with little central direction, but they all share the same approach to target setting, internal contracting, and cross-unit coordination. Okay, this may not work for government because you don't want every office implementing the law differently. And so where our model, where the corporate model is going to have to end and the government model is going to have to pick up is that, yes, you can have small offices. Yes, you can have decentralized offices. They still have to follow the overall policy and the overall law because they can't implement the laws they see fit. But they can still be much more responsive and representative than a bunch of bureaucrats sitting in Washington dictating to people what they do. All right, I'm going to skip the next section because it mostly concerns money and that wouldn't apply to government. Third section is from internal monopolies to internal contracting. This is in most organizations, a significant percentage of employees are insulated from market forces. And I could say in most government organizations, a significant percentage of employees are insulated from the people. Okay. Anyway, it says they work in functions that are, in essence, internal monopolies, such as human resources, research and development, manufacturing, finance, information technology, and legal affairs. Same can be said for government agencies. However inept or inefficient these internal providers may be, they can't be fired by the units they serve. Oh, there's a problem. At hire, every microenterprise is free to buy services or not from other microenterprises. A typical user ME, that's microenterprise, will have agreements with dozens of nodes. If an ME believes an external provider would better meet its needs, it can go outside for services. Senior executives virtually never interfere with internal negotiations. So, you know, that'd be interesting too. So if a government agency needs to contract for, you know, extra workers, extra stuff, you know, whatever it is they're doing, that's the kind of place where they'd be free to do what they want. Like I said, the law they'd have to implement, you know, as written. Okay, the policies would have to be done as written, but the way they get things done, you know, the human resource, the people, the, you know, the different ways that they reach out to people to serve their whatever their community is for their agency, that would be up to them, the small independent government office. That's where I see this is actually working. And again, it's just an idea. It's going to have problems. We'll see what we can work through. And of course, once it's tried, then you're going to find out how it really works. Back to the article. Each year, every market-focused microenterprise looks at its performance objectives and asks itself, slow down, Greg, and asks itself, what sort of design, technology, production, and marketing support will we need to meet these goals? Once it has the answer, it asks the nodes for bids. Usually two or three nodes will respond to proposals. The ensuing discussions provide an opportunity for all parties to challenge existing practices and brainstorm new approaches. Okay, that's a great idea for a corporation. Now, where this would really apply to government is in budgeting. So Congress, when they do the budgets of these agencies, they should ask them, you know, ask them, you know, what opportunity do you have for parties to challenge existing practices? What, you know, how do you, how have you found ways to be more efficient? How have you, who's big, I'll tell you who's big on this is Rush Limbaugh. Rush was famous for talking about zero-based budgeting. And what that is the zero, the base of a government budget is what they got last year. And this is why the incentive, the overwhelming incentive, is to spend every bit of money in last year's budget allocation so they can get as much or more money next year. And that's how governments grow. See, I would do just the opposite. I would automatically reduce those that spend all their money, and I would reward the government departments that, you know, reduce by 10%, 20%, 30%, whatever. Those are the ones where I would look more seriously about expanding their programs. The ones that just spend money just to spend money so they can get more money next year, I'd fire them.
No, what it should.
But that's me. Yeah, go ahead, Pianki.
Every year you should start off at zero, like your voter registration.
Yeah, exactly. So that's for those of you that are new to us here, that's one of my bills. Is that I wrote it for the state of Florida, but it would apply anywhere, that all voter registrations expire at midnight December 31st. And you just register, in January, like you to vote, like you register your car every year. You know, I think the vote is at least as important as your car. You know, so anyway, yeah. Jackie?
You know, another thing too, and I think I understand what you're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why one bureaucracy is so efficient, and that's the Federal Aviation Administration,
uh-huh.
is because when times come for them to go off into another area, for instance, like drones, they allowed a long period for public input
mm-hmm.
and professional input on how to regulate this industry, this new emerging industry. And it works out fine. You have to
have the public input
and professional input.
Yeah. FAA is a pretty good success story. I worked with the FAA as a flight instructor. I had to, and so and I found that although one of the best things they did was block the idea of private fees, funding the air traffic control system, and so that was huge for general aviation. First of all, it's not that big a part of the budget, but the idea that, pilots, with all the expensive aviation we have to pay for, for the tower to stay, clear for takeoff, give me a break. But the FAA did some really good things, and it's interesting. And here's something we should talk about, too. I'm going to do an aviation show sometime in the near future because I've discovered, it's on my Facebook page, I should make this one public, too, these wonderful airplanes coming out of Europe. And our FAA is looking at new regulations, and AOPA, the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, the biggest consumer representative of pilots for general aviation, is working with the FAA to try and get these European airplanes here, because right now, aviation, it's really expensive to fly. I mean, it's ridiculously expensive. And so they're trying to bring in these light aircraft that have Rotax engines, which are basically ultralight engines, that have 150 horsepower, turbocharged. So you can go up to like 18,000 feet. You're almost up at airline level. And you can and they have oxygen. And this is a little airplane. It costs like a couple $100,000, which is a lot. But, the operating cost, it burns 5 gallons an hour of fuel and does over 200 miles an hour at 5 gallons an hour. That's 5 gallons for 200 miles. Try driving 200 miles. Try doing that in your car, driving 200 miles on 5 gallons.
Yeah, TVM 850 uses about 60 gallons an hour. That's the turboprop. A plane itself.
Yeah, exactly.
But the thing I like about the FAA,
uh-huh.
I think when you go for your flight planning and people that's listening, you have to list where you're going to go, where you're going to stop, where you're going to refuel, what altitude you're going, what course, what else your flight planning. But they allow private and third parties to provide those services, like
uh-huh.
Four Flight is one, and you got Sky Vector. Flight is another. So that in itself helped create jobs, create businesses in the United States.
Yeah, see, we used to have something in aviation when I was learning to fly when I was a kid. We had what they called flight service stations, and you could go get a personal briefing at pretty much any airport that had a control tower. And so it was really a trip to be able to go. And some airports that didn't have control towers. Ukiah was a place when I was teaching students to fly in the early 90s. We'd fly up to Ukiah from the San Francisco Bay Area, and they had a flight service station. And we'd actually see the weather maps and the charts, and you had the little indicators, the weather beams, and little cup things measuring wind speed and direction and the humidity and the barometric pressure. And people actually saw how the weather was done. And that was an incredible education for my students. They don't have that anymore. It's all done by phone and internet and duets and all these other things. And I've been out of it for a while, so I have to relearn, how to get my weather and how to do all these things to see what's happening. But those were fun, and they removed that personal connection. But you can think of flight service stations as a microcosm idea for how the FAA, you could personally go talk to someone in the FAA, get a personal weather briefing, and in the same way that the microcosm of the flight service stations might be a model for our new bureaucracy model of smaller, micro enterprises, or in this case, micro offices scattered around the country serving people directly.
Just like airports.
Agriculture could do it. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like some airports are private, micro, but every airplane that lands there gets paid by the FAA. Did you know that?
The FAA pays the airports per landing?
Yeah, you allow on that plane to land, you're maintaining that plane, you provide the service. Yes, there is a fee for, sometimes these fees are picking up by the FAA.
Huh, I didn't know that. Yeah, I've never run an airport, but it's interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, and we need our aviation. You don't want to talk about a vital infrastructure. I mean, where do you think your airline pilots come from? Especially the military is cutting back. Military is going to go more for drones. I don't expect drone airplanes. Oh, drone airliners. That would be scary. But as military pilots, what's that?
You're going to have jets and, like, travel in the sky. That's what's coming next.
Yeah.
You're going to have vectors where these vehicles can operate at a certain altitude out below general aviation. You're going to have basically highways and side streets in the sky.
Oh, yeah. You're going to have drone highways, you know, below maybe 1,000 feet. You're going to have, or personal drones. People are making drones for personal travel. You know, I've got one on the Action Radio Man page. You know, I've got some pretty cool things there that are interesting to find. But these new technologies are fascinating. And so I'm hoping the FAA does. See, the thing is, a bureaucracy lags behind technology. So when we're talking about innovation, airplanes are a perfectly good example. Europe has got the right idea. There's a new category of airplanes called light sport aircraft. In the United States, they limit them to, I think, 1,200 to 1,600 pounds. I forgot what it is. But they can't go faster than 120 knots, which is like 132 miles an hour. They can't have more than 150 horsepower engine. They have to be operated in daylight, you know, two-seater. They have all these restrictions on it. And they have a separate license that you can get, sport pilot license or recreational pilot or things like that. But Europe has gone a different way because flying is so expensive in Europe. But at least a lot of places are closer, so it made sense for Europe. What they do, they don't have the speed restrictions. They have the weight restrictions. They may or may not have the power restrictions, but what they do have in these wonderful these 800-pound airplanes, right, is they have retractable gear, flaps, a constant speed prop, which means the blade angle can change, which makes it much more efficient. And these things do 200 knots. They go over 200 miles an hour. You know, in a plane that's carbon fibers, it weighs 800 pounds. I mean, that's hysterical. I love it. So the technology is here. What we need to do is have the regulation catch up with the technology. And I'm hoping the FAA does that because that would be a great example of bureaucracy. Like you're saying, the FAA does a pretty good job of getting things to where they're supposed to be, I think. But they have their problems too. But you know,
That is some innovation that's coming about. There's going to have to be a lot of support, innovation, support services that go along with it. Also, but it creates opportunities.
Well, see, a flight school probably could get, you know, especially if they bought a few of them, they might have a discount on buying some of these light sport aircraft, these European ones. The LSR, I think, is an example. Let me look it up on my Facebook page. I'll tell you exactly what it is, so people can look it up. Facebook, scroll. So that happens when I run the show. My everything is slower. Where'd I put it? Oh, I guess it's down a bit past my bureaucracy articles. Past the Gestapo
police. Educational systems to go along with that.
Educational systems for what? Oh, here we go. Almost got to it. Well, this is way far down. You know, something else, too, you'll find that Facebook will routinely not post all your articles. You have to refresh the screen to get all of them. They'll leave stuff out if they don't want you to see it, I think.
I would like to see the demise of Facebook myself. Facebook pulled some tactics here lately, in the last couple of years, that just deplorable.
Yeah. We're talking about a bureaucracy, big tech. You want to talk about a bureaucracy? Big tech is a huge bureaucracy. That's why I wrote my bill. On redoing Section 230, so they wouldn't have control over any censorship anymore. In fact, they couldn't restrict any content. It's not their job. We already have obscenity laws. We don't need them to do it on top of it. Let me see if I can find this thing.
Well, not only do they try to control your input with censorship, but they also are trying to control your thinking and your behavior.
Yeah. Oh, that's for sure. That's a whole different thing. I can't find my article. Let me go back to, I know it's in the first one. I don't even know if this is going to come across. You may hear the video in the background when I hold it, but it's such a cool deal. Let's see if I can find it. Here comes YouTube. And it's going to take too long. I'm going to I'll do it later. Anyway, I'll post it. I'll make it a public posting. But I believe it's the LSR airplane. All right, so much for that. Let's get back to this. We've got about 20 minutes before Dr. Pry gets here. So the next section of this that I want to cover, section four, we're skipping a couple of sections in the article, from top-down coordination to voluntary collaboration. This will work for corporations, you know, I mean, obviously the corporate model, but I think this could definitely be applied to let's see how it can be applied to government. It says, how does a company with more than 4,000 independent operating units synchronize major investments in technology and facilities? How does it build cross-business capabilities such as manufacturing automation? It says, in a startup, coordination happens spontaneously. When there's a problem, people simply huddle and hash things out. As a company grows and operating units become more siloed, coordination becomes increasingly difficult. The typical solution involves more layers, mandates, and corporate-level functions. Hire has a different approach, organizing all microenterprises into platforms. Some platforms bring together MEs, microenterprises, operating in a similar category, like washing or audiovisual products. We were talking about the refrigerators earlier. While others focus on building new capabilities such as digital marketing and mass customization. A typical industry platform encompasses more than 50 microenterprises. So the same thing can happen here. So the government could coordinate, you know, their micro offices on certain areas and leave them to innovate on others. And that's how they would do it. And we got organizational charts here. I'm going to skip over all that. Skip, skip, skip. Don't need that. From rigid boundaries to open innovation. And this, I think, does apply to government. Bureaucracies are insular. Typically, they make sharp distinctions between insiders and outsiders and are characterized by secrecy and a reluctance to tap external partners for mission-critical tasks. The problem with a closed system is that it doesn't adapt, it atrophies. Recognizing this, Hire sees itself not as a company, but as a hub in a much larger network. The implications of this view are profound. Well, think about Action Radio. What's the first reaction to Action Radio in everything I've talked about? Reaction is no. Right? Can you guys hear me? Hello, hello.
Yeah, we can hear you. Keep talking.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure.
you're coming in loud and clear.
Okay, I get worried when I don't hear anything. But yeah, but the typical, I think Action Radio is a perfect example of the fact that we are innovative. We are the next evolution beyond talk radio. We've added a citizen legislator to our program in ways that no one else has ever thought of before. And yet the first reaction from everybody I talk to in radio is the same. No. Except Mike. You know, Mike Bates, the only person in radio that was willing to give me a chance, and look what we've been able to do with it. And so, you know, we're going to create an entirely new genre of radio because one person, you know, let me try it, let me start it. And that's how it happens. But I had to, it took me years to find that one person. You know, yeah, go ahead.
You know, another thing, too, when you talk about bureaucracies really have an inner effect of dumbing down the population because you're creating these agencies. You're using some nepotism in order to hire employees and people that run these agencies. And what you're doing is dumbing down the population because the tasks that these agencies perform, people have the power to perform those themselves and get better results that can be more meaningful.
Yeah, and what it really comes down to is, like I say, governments are the worst when it comes to insular. You know, the EPA people talk to the EPA people. They don't talk to anybody else. You know, it's like, oh, look at the health bureaucrats. Talked about, you know, if you listen to Scott Atlas was on Tucker Carlson recently, talking about how Dr. Fascist, Dr. Birx, you know, Dr. Howard, Dr. Fine, Dr. Howard, and Dr. Redfield would go to meetings with Atlas, Dr. Atlas. They had no information. They had no data. They had no reports. They had no studies. They had nothing. They just had their own personal prejudices, which is really all they brought to the meeting, that they are right. And they reinforced that they are right. And they had this pact that if any one of them got fired, they'd all quit. Okay. So to them, it was more important to be insular, to be loyal to their philosophy of, you know, vaccines only. And it didn't matter what the rest of the country was thinking or feeling, or the fact that, you know, millions of people are being injured and many thousands are being killed by these vaccines. They didn't care because it was the cause. It was the loyalty. It was the political philosophy. It was the are you one of us or not philosophy of the health bureaucrats that is as insular. It's like the worst qualities of bureaucracy are exemplified right there in Dr. Howard, Dr. Fine, and Dr. Howard, Dr. Birx, Dr. Redfield, and Dr. Fascist. And so you can see how this all comes together. There's no innovation. Vaccines are it. There is no other option. You know, any other option gets killed.
Well, you know,
it's perfect. The perfect example of the worst bureaucracy, I think, out there right now. Go ahead, Bianchi.
Well, this all falls back on education. By not having the proper biology teaching in your educational system, then governors have to have a news conference where he instructs people that they should wash their hands with hot water. And that there is just really lunacy, myself. People should already know some of the things that they're making all these efforts to speak about in news conferences in order to push up their ratings for the next bureaucracy that they want to hit.
Yeah, I don't need a government official to tell me to wash my hands. Did you have more, Pianki?
Oh, that's it right now.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Yeah, and this idea that the nanny state, the idea that they have to babysit us and they treat us like kids, and they really do. You know, or what's the idea? Treat us like mushrooms, feed us on you know what, and keep us in the dark. You know, we really need to completely open up these things. We need to. There's got to be a way to decentralize, to channel. I mean, there's got to be a way to. You know, you would think. I mean, this is Congress's job, is to have oversight over these people, and they're not doing their job either. So actually, Action Radio, the citizen legislature, is the oversight over Congress that they're not doing for themselves. It's the bills that they can't write. It's the things that they can't do because they're so entrenched and they're so dependent on money from big pharma and other big agriculture, big whatever, that they can't function effectively in the world anymore because their allegiance is not to the people, it's to their donors, and that's a problem. But there's still more of us than them, and if we have at some point I'm looking, I don't know where that point is going to be, but my goal is at some point, you know, if we get enough citizen lobbyists, enough public pressure, enough public approval, the polls, even the polling. If the polling is stronger than the impact of the dollars that a corporation gives, like let's take Archer Daniels Midland, you know, with the ethanol subsidy, there's no reason to put salad dressing in your car. Okay. Cars run on gasoline. Gasoline should be 100% gasoline. It shouldn't be 10% corn oil. All right. But Archer Daniels Midland has bought, you know, 10% of your gasoline with lobbying and with campaign contributions. Okay. So what I'm saying is if enough people object to that and we educate enough people, we write a bill saying there will be no more subsidies for ethanol. We'll just find that place in the law where the subsidy exists, change it. It's probably one sentence. And if enough people start saying, well, we're not going to vote for you if you're going to continue this ridiculous subsidy, that's how we can be more powerful than them. That's how we can, you know, votes and people and public opinion can be stronger than corporate dollars and special interest dollars and George Soros' dollars. But we have to get the people. And I don't know where that point is. I don't know how big we have to be, how many people, what percentage of the polls have to be there to impact elections and impact candidates where they have more, I guess, influence or allegiance to people and votes as opposed to special interest and money. That's going to be the big question.
Well, also there's got to be basic education that's taught in the schools starting off as young as possible. They have to understand what exists and how it benefits you and how it applies and should be worked.
Yeah.
You know, take this case down in Georgia where these three men was chasing this young man and shooting at it. Well, at some point in their educational career, they should have known that you can't do that because the laws does not work that way. So when you don't know the law, when you don't know the rules and regulations, it amplifies that lack of knowledge, that ignorance, then it causes all kind of problems down the road.
Yep, sure does. Yeah, and then this is why we do so much with the Constitution and talk about individual rights and you know, be an education service ourselves. Here's another part. This is one of the last two, part number six here, from innovation phobia to entrepreneurship at scale. And I still believe this can be applied to government as well. It says there's a reason big companies are frequently outmaneuvered by newcomers. That would be us at Action Radio to the big radio networks. Just watch. It's coming. It's going to happen. Anyway, bureaucracies are intrinsically conservative. This is coming from Harvard, okay? So when they talk about conservative, they're not talking about political. They're talking about, you know, conserving what was, okay? And that's actually the definition of conservative. And Lawrence J. Peter, author of The Peter Principle, well, I didn't know that was his name. Oh, that makes sense. All right. He says, bureaucracy defends the status quo long past the time the quo has lost its status. I love that. To counter this reverence for precedent, many companies have set up outposts in Silicon Valley and other innovation hotspots. Hire, by contrast, has turned its entire organization, that's the company, the Chinese utility, what are those things called? Appliance company, there we go. Hire, by contrast, has turned its entire organization into a startup factory. Think about that. Turn its entire this works for companies too. They should be listening to this. Turn its entire organization into a startup factory. It's 50-odd incubating micro-enterprises currently account for more than 10% of Hire's market cap. They run the gamut from Hire Youngji, a fintech startup. All right, anyways, this is getting technical. But the point is, smaller is better. Big companies can operate like small companies if they decentralize and have small offices. I think big government can do exactly the same thing. I just don't know how yet. So that's what we shall see. And the last one is from employees to owners. In the startup, people tend to think and act like owners. Well, that's us. We're the owners. You know, often they have equity in the venture, and some will even have risked their own capital in hopes of scoring a big win. That would be me. Startup teams also have a large degree of autonomy and no one to blame if things go wrong. If this combination of upscale freedom and accountability, it is this combination of upside, freedom, and accountability that gives startups their edge. So we're a startup. I mean, we really are. Okay, we're just not known as well as we're going to be, hopefully very soon. This is a study of 780 U.S. companies published by the National Bureau of Economic Research explored the connection between gain, sharing, autonomy, and voluntary turnover rates, which the authors use as a proxy for employee engagement. Yeah, some companies, I think Avis, isn't everybody at Avis Car Rental, aren't they all owners? Aren't there employee-owned companies that are highly successful?
No, no.
They all profit share. And, yeah, I think so. Gene, if you have a second, if you can grab that before Dr. Pry gets here. Look at Avis or just, you know, large employee-owned companies. I think some of them are very successful because not only do they pay salaries, but they give stock. They do profit sharing. You know, and so that's I think that is the way to operate a company. It makes sense to me. Anyway, it says, turns out company's potential business. Okay, turns out neither gain sharing nor autonomy on its own has significant impact on turnover. But in companies that offered employees both, voluntary turnover was less than half the rate observed when one or none of these two conditions was present. So that would be autonomy, gain sharing, and autonomy. So autonomy, you get to make your own decisions, and gain sharing would be like profit sharing. Okay. And those two I think are critical, and that's going to happen here at Action Radio too. Anyway, he says that makes sense. If you increase employees' authority without increasing their upside, the additional responsibility may well be seen as a burden. Conversely, if you grant people stock without increasing their authority, they'll still feel like minions. At Hire, microenterprises are expected to be self-managing, and their freedoms are formally enshrined in three rights: strategy, the right to decide what opportunities to pursue, to set priorities, and to form both internal and external partnerships. People, the right to make hiring decisions, align individuals and roles, and define working relationships. And distribution, the right to set pay rates and distribute bonuses. I absolutely agree with all of that. And we'll try and exemplify that with Action Radio as it goes forward. And it's got more stuff here. I don't want to do any more.
And you know,
too good.
Those that take on hard subjects, hard topics, they should be rewarded with higher pay.
Yep.
Also.
Mm-hmm.
And you need micro businesses. The same way you need apps in order for you to get the greatest efficiency and use out of your smartphone.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, smartphone. Well, here's the thing, too. I mean, I don't think our humanity has caught up with the technology. Technology is so advanced, so useful, so incredible, but we haven't found ways to best use it yet. All right, I'm just checking out.
Well,
go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Just like politicians should not be voting their conscience, they should be voting the law, what the law says.
Yeah, would be nice.
Too often when they vote their conscience, you get into these long, drawn-out enterprises that never seem to have an end.
Why don't I mind voting your conscience? If you're voting independently, you're voting what you believe. That's not a problem. I don't think.
Well, I don't think that. I think you should vote for law because you're still voting what you believe.
Oh,
I
see what you're saying.
They should
be voting
what their constituents want. Because they're not voting their conscience. They should be, they shouldn't be voting what they think is best. They should be voting what their constituents tell them is best.
And what if their constituents vote themselves, $10,000 a month, living wage?
Well, the thing is, that's pretty much what Congress is doing now. They're giving themselves mega bucks that no one else gets.
Okay, what if they vote that self-defense is not a right anymore?
Well, yeah, that's why come you have to have smart, educated constituents.
Yes, yeah, so
they won't
thing,
be
though.
Coming with these outlandish, unlawful ideas.
But, but the thing is, if that's what they want, you are elected by the people of your area. So you should be voting what they want. And
okay.
The thing is with that, if they don't like it, it's part of the person. You need educate and say, hey, this is, you know, this have town halls, stuff like that.
Okay.
But basically, I mean, if basically that's why people get voted, not why they get voted out. Pelosi should have been voted out a long time ago, in my opinion. But
yeah.
The thing is, it's like, who else votes for you? We don't want someone from another, you know, area to come and vote in your area. Why? Because they don't know your area.
Yeah.
And it's people that live there are not up to your liking, then you may have to go find a place where you like. I mean, I know a lot of people that are moving because of taxes, because of laws, because of COVID. And it's like, yeah, you know, it's like then find your tribe, find your area if you can.
Yeah,
some people just can't up and move. I get that.
Now, let me jump in here.
I agree
quick.
With you,
we only got a couple of minutes before Dr. Pry gets here. Gene, what you're talking about and why this is so dangerous is the dirty little secret is that the legislators are not to do exactly what their constituents want. Now that sounds kind of, you know, wait a minute, we've been told they're representatives. No, their job is to protect the rights of the individuals against the majority. So
no, because
function,
then it makes it sound don't know what's best for us, and they know what's best for us. Then we have the same mess we got now.
I disagree, and I'll tell you why. Because the people, you know, the old saying is once 51% of the people realize they can vote themselves 49% of the upper income is money, society falls apart. So you don't want a democracy. You want a republic. And what a republic does, I know what you're saying, but this is why these folks have to exercise leadership and judgment when popular will may not think that that's the way to go. So there's a balance in here. So the dirty little secret of freedom is a lot of times freedom actually has to be imposed in ways through a republic to guarantee our freedom that a democracy would take away. Because if you go strictly by popular will, then you get these horrendous, you know, you get things like California, which has absolutely awful laws. Now, they have a ballot proposition, which actually made sense because that way you can go past a legislature that's not functioning properly. The problem is money. People spend so much money on the ballot initiatives to benefit special interests while convincing people it's really for the common good, and it's not. And so you have to be very careful I'm going to say this bluntly, you can't have too much democracy. Because democracy kills the society and leads to socialism and communism. Because people will always vote their self-interest for greed before they vote for individual rights and work and responsibility. And so the dirty secret of freedom, again, the reason for a republic is to impose a situation on a country that guarantees freedom, protect individual rights, you know, at the expense of popular will. And that's I know that sounds like a conflict, but it's not. And then you're going to say, well, Greg, you write legislation we'll take a look at the stuff we write. Okay, everything we do here is a Republican form of legislation that protects individual rights, that advances rights, that limits the powers of government, that allows you the maximum freedom. That's what
then
we do
we
here.
We are screwed.
No, we're not.
And the reason I say that, then we got bobbleheads like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz that are all talk and no action. I was reading something last night
about
her, and I really liked her at first. But they're like Fauci. They like to be in the media. They like to thump their chest and say, look at me, I'm doing something. But they've done zero squat.
Exactly. Now, if they start advancing our citizen legislation, I will change my opinion. But I agree with you absolutely, especially Matt Gaetz, because I'm in his district. He's known us since March 1st of 2017, because used to be on my show every week. So the idea that he hasn't advanced some of our citizen legislation when he agreed to in 2018 with our mandatory citizenship question on the census bill, which was an excellent bill, which he took to Washington. That's the last time he's had any real contact with us, which is really too bad because we got a ton of good ideas like the Department of Innovation, about decentralizing bureaucracy, about having a new philosophy of government. These are the things we should be talking about. But it's not a straight democracy.
Well, I understand what Gene is saying, and a lot of it I agree. But it still goes back to one common factor. You have to have constituents, people that are well-educated and understand what they have been born into and understand how they're supposed to work. Yes, as people knew that they were supposed to require their legislatures to address the problem with voter fraud before it went to Congress on the Senate floor that day in January 6th, then much of that would not have ever happened.
Right. And the courts could have done it too, and Mike Pence could have sent the electors back when he had a duplicate set. He had both Biden and Trump electors. He could have sent it back to the states and said, send me one. There were so many places where this election could already have been changed, you know, but so the buildings and the Marxists conspired to put in a false administration, you know, so that is a denial of a republic. That is a denial of our constitutional rights, you know, and in fact, you know, and they're saying, well, the majority voted for it, you know, so there's your democracy. You know, it's not the majority didn't vote for it. You know, so
and you'd be surprised the level of stupidity. I was arguing with a teacher who insists that parents have no right on what he or she teaches their children. I say that's not true. He said it is true. I say we read the law. He said I'm interpreting the law wrong. So that level of ignorance is more prevalent than what you think.
Oh no! Believe me, I never underestimate the lack of intelligence of the American public, and that's why you know this is why the founding fathers were only 1/3 of the population. They literally imposed freedom, because in order for us to be free, we have to drag everybody else with us. That's a sad fact. That's simply the way it goes. Dr. Pryor's on the line now too, so I'll get to him in a second. But this is critical, and we need I need to talk more about the differences between a republic and a democracy and why it's so critical that individual rights take place, you know, that are supreme to majority rule. And they have to be, because the majority can be coerced, can be bought, can be corrupted, can be – look at vaccine mandates. If everybody in the country, you know, except me, you know, wanted vaccine mandates, would I still have to have one? No, because I still have the rights of an individual, okay? And so that's the difference. But if you go majority rule, it'd be like if a jury could make decisions, you know, 7-5. As opposed to majority 12, okay? Well, majority rules, right? It's a democracy. No, it's not. Okay, so that's the difference.
But then why vote?
For good representation. You're voting for the representation of a representative republic. You're voting for the people whose number one duty, although they don't do it, whose number one duty is to protect your rights, you know, life, liberty, and property. That's what it's about. And your individual right to pursue your happiness. Okay. Doesn't guarantee your happiness, and rights, just to make this really clear, you don't have a right to something that somebody else has to give you. So if it costs somebody else money or time, it's not a right. A right is something that you exercise on your own. All right, which means you may have to, you know, to exercise your Second Amendment rights, you got to buy a gun. Okay, you're not going to be issued one. You're not going to be given one. All right, health insurance, health care is not a right. If it costs somebody else to do it, or if it costs somebody else's time, like a doctor, you know, they should be paid for their service. So a right is something that you're not given. A right is something you exercise individually that doesn't cost somebody else time or money. And if you think of it that way, it's a whole different concept. Anyway, let me get to Dr. Pryor here. We're going to continue this. Gina, we need to talk more about this, because you've raised an incredibly important point on the difference between democracies and republics, and we need to do more of that. But in the meantime, let's talk nuclear weapons, EMP, and China flying over Taiwan and all the other things. And maybe we'll get a tour through the new nuclear weapons that are coming out now. I'm just looking for Dr. Pryor's here it is, theme, and we'll be right back.
What is national security? How much is enough? What about the cost? What are our adversaries doing? Who wins between the State Department and the Pentagon? How accurate is our intelligence capability? Are we keeping up with our nuclear deterrent? Do we have better weapons than our adversaries? How would we know? Can we withstand an EMP attack? How is our missile defense? How about the basic power grid? Is it safe? These are the questions Dr. Pryor has been dealing with his whole career. Dr. Peter Vincent Pryor is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He has served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He is the author of The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. And now he anchors the National Security Report here on Action Radio. How much national security is enough? And now, Dr. Peter Vincent Pryor.
You know, it's funny, we get into some of these rip-roaring discussions right before you come on. it just happened. We've been analyzing bureaucracy and how to decentralize it and come up with an entirely new model. And our example was this company in China, this appliance company, totally decentralized their operation. They have like 4,000 independent units across China with only 10 to 15 people. And I thought, can I apply that to government? So that's what we've been talking about this morning. It's been interesting.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. And the last question that was asked, too, about why should we vote? Because that's still a good question. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've read, I'm sure you must have read Molly Hemingway's Rigged, because she, in effect, she really, she doesn't really introduce anything new, but I think it's but she documents well and makes the case all in one book about the various ways in which the Democrats clearly stole the 2020 elections. And all of those things they've done are still in place and haven't been reversed. And, I keep hearing, from conservatives and conservative channels about how we're going to get a huge majority in the midterm elections and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've heard
people
that
have been given hope. Yeah, people have been given hope by the fact that the election that the Republicans managed to win Virginia, for example, here in Virginia, with Youngkin, and I hope that is a good sign. But instead of continuing your other conversation, perhaps we should talk about national security, which is what this is supposed to be.
But if you want to address Gene's question, then we're going to say this up again: why should you vote? That is an amazing question. But again, I'll get to the differences between a democracy and a republic, and why a republic works and a democracy doesn't. Even though we talk about people doing what the people want, and yes and no, and this is where it gets kind of dicey. But anyway, so national security.
I think
you're always welcome to address Gene's questions anytime you want to. So feel free to address her directly.
I think it's a sign of the degeneration of our of Americans understanding basic civics,
mm-hmm. Yes.
That we constantly use the word democracy, that we're a democracy.
I never use it.
Democracy. When, as you well know, the founders considered democracy to be one of the worst forms of government, and they did deliberately wanted to avoid establishing democracy because it's so prone to, in effect, what you were describing, mob rule, and mm-hmm. and minority rights, don't get protected, and it's also subject to demagoguery so easily. They're very familiar with the history of the classical world, and how the Athenians, we've often talked on this thing about the Peloponnesian Wars and why Athens lost to Sparta, a military dictatorship, and one of the reasons was that they were a democracy, and they would, when anything went wrong, they would actually fire and sometimes even execute the generals, because the mob wanted their blood for mm-hmm. losing a battle somewhere, and then they would listen to some other group of people and would follow a zigzag kind of a policy. And eventually spiraled down into defeat because they weren't capable of consistently staying the course for a long, for a protracted period of time. It's one of the reasons they were defeated. And in a lot of ways, our own society, because of mass media, we are acquiring more of the characteristics we're supposed to be a constitutional republic, right?
Mm-hmm.
But are we? We are actually acquired because of the mass media and the extreme lack of balance in our mass media, that it represents only one point of view all the time. We are acquiring a lot of the characteristics of a democracy. And that I think that accounts for a lot of our problems, even to the point where you can't, where it's really hard to get a fair trial. You can be a teenage kid on trial for your life,
in a clear-cut case
of self-defense, and it's hard to get a clerk because the mob is crying for your blood. That's what a democracy is like.
I define it as the difference between a republic and a democracy. In a republic, you have a trial by jury and evidence and rules, and in a democracy, you have a lynch mob.
Right, exactly.
Good distinction. In the simplest terms, star terms.
That's really what it comes down to. And, the founders, well, anyway. But I do think it's an example of the confusion over democracy versus republic, an example of how people just, we're not teaching civics in school anymore, and people just don't understand that, the distinction between them and what kind of a society we're supposed to be, what kind of government we're supposed to be. But moving on to national security issues, you and I have often talked about Russia and China coordinating their activities so that you might have a scenario where when Russia invades Ukraine and maybe attacks the frontline NATO states, that China will coordinate with Russia because they are, in effect, strategic allies, even though the State Department doesn't want to admit that or recognize that, and that they would attack Taiwan simultaneously, you know, mm-hmm. overtaxing us because we can barely, even on our own war games, we're not even winning, in one theater anymore. I mean, it used to be during the Cold War that the United States was supposed to be able to prevail in 2.5 theaters, you know, in a future war. Now it's down to one theater, and we don't even prevail in our own war games when we're fighting the one theater thing. But I was interested to see in the Diplomatic Courier, which is a journal magazine for people who are like foreign affairs. It's sort of like a version of Foreign Affairs for people who, you know, are part of the national security and diplomatic establishment. That they actually have an article.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Well, it sounds like the club, so like an insulated group of people that...
Council of Foreign Relations type people read it, you know.
Yeah, okay.
And, but they actually, that light bulb suddenly went on over their head because we're facing this situation for the second time this year, you know, where there's real fear about the possibility of Russia just deciding to invade Ukraine and, again, maybe keep going, you know. And the Diplomatic Courier raises, well, you know, what if China attacks Taiwan at the same time? I mean, that could really happen. And in fact,
yeah,
and they arrive at a proper, right.
Yeah.
They arrive at the proper conclusion that the consequences of such a thing would be a mega Afghanistan. And that could change world order. I mean, that would basically be it for the United States as the leader of the free world. Because, it would completely destroy our credibility. And China and Russia surely realize that. Our own war games show that we cannot defend Ukraine or the NATO frontline states, and we can't defend Taiwan from China. And so why not? And that this could be, you know, the supreme crisis that we've been drifting toward. I personally don't think it will be, but... Because we're in such a national security free fall, you know, I think they're going to want to wait to see just how low we go before the possibility of winning without war is a real possibility for them. So why risk a war? But I could be wrong about that. December 7th is fast approaching. You know, totalitarian states like to wade in their enemy's blood.
They love symbolism.
You know, they might not. Yeah, exactly.
Well, here's a big question for you. We were the leader of the free world after World War II. We had the military. We had the factories. Our nation was not bombed. We didn't lose 20 million, Soviet Union under Stalin. Germany lost, I don't know how many millions of people. But, we were in the best shape after World War II. We could be the leader of the free world because we're the only people that had all our stuff, you know, and our factories and our economy, you know, somewhat intact. That's not the situation now. You've got competitors all over the world. And my question is, should we be the leader of the free world, or should we have alliances with Australia, Japan, India, you know, countries around the world, Saudi Arabia, you know, different places around the world. So we build a coalition of not necessarily the free nations, but, you know, like the Abraham Accords in the Middle East. You know, are we better off with alliances, a more traditional, you know, diplomatic model, as opposed to us being the leader of the free world? Because quite frankly, I don't think we can afford to be the leader of the free world. So I want to look beyond that to a different model for operating in the world, you know, as a major influence of freedom, you know, but not responsible for being the leader of the free world. How's that sit with you?
Yeah, I think we've kind of talked about this on previous show, but, because the paradigm that came out of the Cold War, basically the generation that fought World War II, you know, Eisenhower, Truman, mm-hmm. they didn't want to establish an American empire, you know, where our allies would cease to be allies and that we would basically be, you know, taking care of them, defending them. Mm-hmm. You know, they were supposed to be pulling their own weight. You know, it was never supposed to be. And we've had even in our agreements, the idea that, you know, they're supposed to be spending a certain percentage of their gross national products on their own defense harkens mm-hmm. back to those more sober times, you know, when we were supposed to be heading a coalition of allies, you know, all of whom had equal responsibilities for defending themselves and helping us.
Yeah.
And in fact, the United States was never supposed to end up being a global policeman where we would get involved in these petty Middle Eastern wars, the series of defeats that we've had, you know, that's why you have allies, you know, the allies in the center in the theater were supposed to handle the small stuff and we would be held back. We would be the great power balancer so that if one of the big boys got involved, like Russia, okay, mm-hmm. Soviet Union back then we would come into it, mm-hmm. you know. But as we know, you know, that role, you know, the Washington with as we moved away from that World War II generation, and you know, ended up with a State Department that had this globalist vision. You know, with the United States, you know, I mean, there were various motives, you know, some of them where they wanted to, I mean, some people in the State Department, you know, welcomed the idea, you know.
Yeah. Well, the Korean War comes to mind,
they saw the United States as the new, as an empire more than, you know,
yeah.
more than a world. There's a big difference between being a dominant global power and being mm-hmm. a leader, you know, big difference there, you know,
yeah.
if you're going to dominate, want to be a dominant global power, which is what China and Russia want, you know, you're talking about an empire, an imperial kind of global system. You know, we were supposed to be maybe the first among equals, but still essentially equals and not basically trying to do it all on our own. And yeah, I think a lot of Americans, Trump was trying to get us back to a more mm-hmm. balanced, sensible thing where the cost and the risk of providing for global security would be more balanced and apportioned among our allies the way it's supposed to be, you know, because we can't obviously carry the ball all by ourselves, especially now, you know, when it's clear that we're so far behind, both in technologically and in arguably what's the most important part of the military balance, which is the nuclear area. You know, I mean, that's the main thing that the United States was supposed to do, you know, to deter a nuclear war, to deter a global nuclear war by making sure that we, you know, that we had at least parity with our adversaries, if not superiority over them in at least some of the categories when it came to nuclear weapons and conventional wars, especially conventional wars in theaters, localized wars, you know, were supposed to be managed by our allies. But of course that didn't, we drifted away from that.
Somewhere this went wrong. You know, I'm thinking the globalists took over in Korea. I'd like to know what happened between 1945 when World War II ended and we got into Korea, because it seems like the leadership model that Eisenhower came about was happening right after World War II. And then all of a sudden, you know, the United Nations takes over and the globalists put this into Korea. So I think I see that as like the start of you know, going from leader to, you know, global police force or, you know, world benefactor, you know, paying for everything. The other thing, too, that I find interesting is that we used to have the best weapons in the world. You know, we're the ones that came out with the latest, you know, the newest missiles, the newest airplanes, the newest technology, the newest radar, the newest everything. And the military contractors are going to back that because they want money. So they come out with these really great things. You know, their best scientists are creating stuff, and they're able to equip our military with really good stuff. But then somewhere along the way, you know, we stopped making the best. And I don't know if it's just the State Department. You know, where are the military contractors? Where are the companies that are building really or can build really great, innovative, you know, weapons? And like I say, if we get away from just saying nuclear weapons, like, oh, no, but just say weapons that maybe have nuclear capability, you know, what happened to that whole industry, that whole, you know, aren't there people that are screaming for us to do that, you know, out there and the State Department's fighting them, or what's going on there?
Yeah, well, to take your first point, your last point first, I think it even began in World War II, you know, before we established the thing that we call the United Nations today, you know, which is headquartered in New York City, the Allies were calling themselves the United Nations, you know, and I think even during World War II, there was this, it's really kind of ironic, you know, there's this globalist vision, that was among our, you know, our elites, you know, our Washington elites, especially the State Department, you know, but also in the universities and elsewhere. And Americans were being asked to spend their blood and treasure for patriotic reasons, you know, to defend America. That and obviously the kind of the propaganda that was put out by the government. I hate to call it propaganda because it was true. You know, I mean, our civilization was endangered, but they knew to appeal to people's patriotism because nobody wanted to die for the United Nations, right? But the elites, in their minds, you know, saw using the engine that was the United States to use that engine to drive us in a direction where nationalism would be left behind, and we would establish a new world order based on the United Nations.
Yeah.
You know, even Winston Churchill wrote about, you know, how you know, it was the failure of the League of Nations, and because the U.S. hadn't been part of the League of Nations, that was one of the things that brought on World War II. And that if we could have something more powerful than the League of Nations in the future, maybe that would, you know, maybe that would be the answer to preventing future wars. Although how much Churchill, who was one of the greatest statesmen the West has ever produced, you know, how much he really meant that, you know, or was he simply saying that because he knew that Washington wanted to hear that from him in order to stay in NATO, for example, you know, because the great dilemma for Europe in the aftermath of World War II was, how do we get the Americans to stay? Because the shattered armies of Britain and France and what was left of the German army, there's no way they could have held off the Soviet Union. They needed America to stay. And so so the European countries were ready to think like internationalists, if it meant America would stay and keep and hold back the red tide, you know, they'd be willing to say anything to avoid that.
But it's just,
you know,
the Russians had lost so many people. You know, I heard some staggering statistic that the men who were born in the year 1922 would have been 18 and 1940. 80% of that year's men died in World War II. You know, you couldn't imagine anything like that happening here, and yet they're willing to keep. They would have kept fighting. You know, they would have. You know, Stalin would have taken on us if Patton, you know, had said, convinced, you know, Eisenhower to go to war and convinced Truman to go to war at that point with the then Soviet Union. You know, and so I don't think people understand that as devastated as this country was, they lost 20 million of their own people. I mean, we can come up with comparable numbers in the United States, but just imagine entire cities destroyed and under siege and bombed and fighting in the rubble. You know, you look at that, the film about the Russian sniper, Zaitsev, I've forgotten who plays him, British actor.
Enemy at the Gates.
Yeah.
Right.
Enemy at the Gates, exactly right. And you look at the rubble that these people were defending, these horrible conditions they were living in, and our soldiers, you know, in both fighting both Germany and Japan faced horrible conditions, but the American people didn't. The war never came here. Pearl Harbor, but it didn't destroy Oahu. I mean, it didn't destroy Honolulu. You know, it destroyed the Navy. You know, and so people never really saw the full impact of war that the Russians did, and yet the Russians were still willing to fight on. They would have taken us on if that had happened, as much as they had lost. And I don't think people understand that kind of devastation and still willing to keep going to, you know, for the motherland. It's a whole different concept.
Yeah, right. The great fatherland patriotic war is what they call it in Russia.
Oh, fatherland.
And,
okay. Yeah.
You know, and the Robert Conquest has crunched the numbers on casualties, and it's even the 20 million is a commonly accepted number. However, you know, there are credible estimates that go as high as 30 million war dead. You know, when you include the activities of the you know, of the Nazi death camps against Soviet citizens, 30 million war dead, and then an additional 30 million from the purges that happened, you know, since 1918, since the Bolshevik Revolution. So you're talking about 60 million people killed between World War II and what the Soviets did to their own population. You know, we know for you know, for sure that, you know, it wasn't not sure during the early 30s, there was the Holodomor, the Ukrainian Holocaust. You know, they killed twice as many Ukrainians as they did, as the Soviets killed twice as many Ukrainians as the Nazis did Jews, you know, during the so-called agricultural reform. I mean, these are, you know, so an enormous loss of their population, and yet they were, well, that's one of the advantages of totalitarian states, you know, that you can mobilize and brainwash your population. And they had the brutal experience of what they suffered, you know, at the hands of the Nazis. Actually, they didn't even need that much propaganda to mobilize a lot of these people to take revenge. When you know, when Berlin fell, some historians have argued it was the greatest that more rapes happened in the Battle of Berlin, after the fall of Berlin, than during any other event, similar event in human history, which shows how, even though it was the 20th century, you know, how low we can sink into barbarism as a consequence of these totalitarian wars, you know, between these two states. But yeah, Americans don't realize, and that's one of the things. That's something that average Russians really resent, you know, that we think of ourselves that the suffering that they endured, you know, doesn't seem to really be recognized. You know, we talk about the D-Day invasion, for example, and focus on the accomplishments of General Patton Americans are largely ignorant of what the Soviets had to experience, what they had to do in order to their contribution. And theirs was the more important contribution. I mean, we wouldn't have won World War II if, you know, had it not been for the Eastern Front.
It's like 20 divisions versus 120 divisions. I mean, the war was on the Eastern Front. People don't understand that. The point I want to get to, and getting back to nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it was actually 320 divisions. They
320 divisions.
One of the things, one of the reasons the Nazis lost is the Abwehr made an enormous intelligence failure about how many Russian divisions there were. You know, they thought that there were something like 120 divisions, and that was it. But the Soviets were actually able to mobilize an additional 200 divisions, you know, which is why they found themselves being overwhelmed, you know, on the Eastern Front. They really badly miscalculated the manpower.
But we didn't have anywhere near that. You know, you combine the British, German, and American forces, we're nowhere close to the amount of force in Russia. I mean, I don't know what the proportion was, but most of it was the Eastern Front. But my point I was getting to is that the Russian psychology is, you know, survival at all costs. They don't care what it costs. They're going to survive, and they're going to keep going. And the United States, not having been touched by war, you know, in the same way, we went through, you know, Korea, Vietnam, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, all these different wars, allegedly, undeclared, But the people really didn't see the consequence. And I think because of that, they don't see the need for the nuclear weapons that, you know, we should talk about, some of the third and fourth generation ones, if you want to get onto that, or we can do that another week. But the psychology is so different based on the experience. And even though, you know, the World War II generation has pretty much passed on, it's still, there's, you know, they told their kids and they told their kids, and, you know, and they remember. And you look in the history, you know, just as we look up the Civil War and we look up our war for independence, we can see what happened. I'm sure Russians are required to study World War II in excruciating detail. And that, you know, gets the psychology of, well, we're just going to build whatever we need to defend our country. Even, you know, and so they may look at us, the enemy. I still think they look at each other as the enemy. They'll cooperate in terms of, you know, if Russia attacks Ukraine, China attacks Taiwan at the same time. That, you know, in cold logic, that actually makes sense. I hope they don't.
Yes,
you know,
it does.
Honestly. But if I were planning a strategy, so what is the enemy? If my enemy is my friend. So in other words, China and Russia are friends because they have a mutual enemy, us. But that doesn't mean
exactly.
They wouldn't be enemies if there wasn't an us. But their psychology in China was devastated, you know, from all the dynasties, all through the, you know, the Mao killing hundreds of millions of people there. So these countries survive horrible things. So it makes sense that they would have no problem arming themselves in just such huge proportions, way beyond anything that they might even think they need, because, you know, they never know. They don't know how much they need. They don't know when the next, you know, mass genocide is coming. Whereas we don't think that way here because it's really never happened, which is fortunate, but it creates a different mindset.
Right. And the government exists in our free systems, you know, to advance the interests of the people. We exist to advance the interests of the people. The people are supposed to be in charge. And even the Biden administration will at least pretend that it's acting in behalf of the best interests, you know, of the people, and they probably actually believe that. All right.
Yeah, we'll debate that another
time. But
that's
not the case with these totalitarian systems.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're talking Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union or Communist China, they see themselves, the elites, the revolutionary vanguard, are everything. The revolution is everything. And the them acquiring power and staying power is everything, and the people belong. They're like, you know, they belong to the state. They serve the state, and their lives are expendable. You know, the people's lives are expendable. You know, in free democratic systems where the people are your ultimate value, it matters a lot more if you're taking enormous numbers of casualties. At some point, you have to ask yourself, well, gee, is this contest really in the interest of the people, if it means their virtual extermination? Free systems tend not to take, aren't willing to engage in those kinds of sacrifices. And I have to go back. I want to add something to what we were about before, about the Soviet Union and World War II. Because I don't want to leave the audience with the idea, you know, that, oh, we have a because it's one of the critiques that the new left makes of the West and of the United States is that, you know, World War II was really won by the Soviet Union. And maybe that, and, you know, when you look at the sacrifices, you know, you can say that's true. But, and therefore we owe, you know, a deference or something like that, and that is not true. You know, it is, first of all, the Soviet Union helped bring on World War II because they were originally allied with Nazi Germany, all right, which unleashed the German war machine against the West, and Stalin was going to be perfectly happy. You know, the big strategic mistake that Hitler made was invading the Soviet Union. If he hadn't done that, the Soviets would have been perfectly happy to divide up the world with Nazi Germany. Eventually, they probably would have come to death grips with each other, you know, because totalitarian states are like that. They want to be in total control. But so first of all, you know, there's no burden of guilt or debt on the behalf of the West for what happened to the Soviet Union during World War II, because they were a major actor in bringing on World War II, helping. In fact, they cooperated with Nazi Germany in invading Poland and dividing up the Baltic states. And second, America, you know, bent over backwards to try to help the Soviet Union during World War II, I wonder if they would have won. Many historians can argue that had it not been for the help of the United States, the Soviet Union wouldn't have prevailed on the Eastern Front. You know, we sent them, for example, a million trucks. We sent them thousands of tanks. We sent them food, ammunition, everything we could manage. We suffered enormous losses, you know, in the Arctic Ocean, trying to get to our Murmansk and Archangel, you know, taking enormous losses. Some of those convoys lost more than 50% of the ships trying to get there to deliver that stuff. And this was in addition to the enemy of my enemy as my friend. In addition to that, it was also because we had our eye on the post-Cold War. You know, we were hoping that the Soviet Union would not regard us as an enemy and would appreciate what we did for them in World War II. But they obviously didn't, and they saw us as the enemy anyway, and that's why we ended up with a Cold War. So I just wanted to make that commentary before we moved on, because it was sounding a little bit too new left to me. You know, it's a more complicated situation in terms of the role the Soviet Union played in the World War II versus the United States. I'll tell you, if the situation was reversed and we were being invaded by Nazi Germany, I doubt very much that the Soviets would have done anything, you know, to have helped the West. It was all a one-way street in terms of our sending them supplies and doing everything we could to try to keep them in the fight and keep them from going under.
Well, we never gave them the Marshall Plan. I think that's a big bone of contention. It's like, why'd you rebuild your enemies? You wouldn't
rebuild
your friends.
Yeah, well, by that time,
I've heard that argument too. Yeah.
What they were planning, you know. So of course we had given them every other opportunity. Yeah. We even tried the Baruch Plan. Was that on your show? We talked about that. I think it was.
I think last week we couldn't spell it.
Last week.
We tried to figure out what it was.
Right, yeah. Where we were willing to give up the atomic bomb even and let it be, you know, managed by the United Nations. And that of course, is another example of the globalists, too.
Supreme,
you know, where,
idiocy.
We need this supranational thing that's going to move beyond. But a lot of Americans, I guess the point I was trying to make there is, you know, nobody was telling Americans while we were trying to defeat Nazi Germany, and all these appeals were being made to our nationalism and our patriotism. You know, the State Department wasn't saying, well, you know, our larger plan is basically to move beyond all of this troglodyte patriotism and nationalism and have a supranational body called the United Nations, you know, where we're going to clink champagne glasses and eat caviar in Geneva, you know, while we run the world, But you guys go out there and die fighting the Tiger tanks to make this vision of ours possible, you know.
Interesting. Okay, got about 22 minutes left, so I don't know if we cover where you wanted to talk. You know, I always have questions about what's going on, but did you want to go someplace else?
Well, you mentioned third generation nuclear weapons. Might as well talk about that.
And why we don't produce them?
You know.
I guess there's
something. Yeah.
Well, what's out there? What is
right,
the potential
that,
nuclear
good,
weapons these days? What can they do that nobody knows about? I think that'd be fascinating for people to know because it's not in the news. No one talks about it. We talk about the F-35 and aircraft carriers and things like that, but nobody knows. I think the modern, you know, nuclear, you know, or just these weapons that happen to have nuclear capability, which is the way I like to describe them, so that we don't get all hung up on H-bomb pictures and visions in our head, because that's not the reality anymore. What is for those bombs? But there's so much.
Well. It's the reality for us because we don't have any third generation nuclear weapons. This is where we've been left behind by the Russians and the Chinese, and even by the North Koreans, who've got at least one third generation nuclear weapon in their super EMP weapons. But first, a first generation nuclear weapon is really an atomic weapon. You know, that's a weapon that uses fission, you know, the fissioning of plutonium or uranium to achieve blast and shock. And there's technological limits on the destructive power of fission weapons. I think, you can get up to about a half a megaton, 500 kilotons were the most powerful atomic weapons. And they tended to be really, to get it that big, you know, they tended to be pretty bulky. pretty heavy. A second generation nuclear weapon, true thermonuclear weapon, relies chiefly on fusion to achieve the destructive effects. And you have to, at least the design we use for achieving that, is you've got what's called a primary or a pit, which is a small atomic bomb that uses fission. And that creates temperatures equivalent to the sun. In fact, it uses what's called radiation pressure, light to that is so dense that it's reflected off of mirrors, usually made of uranium, on the interior of the bomb to compress a lithium or tritium, which are very light elements. It's almost the opposite. It works almost on an opposite principle from fission, because you're using the heaviest elements, plutonium and uranium, if you look on a chemical chart, are among the heaviest elements known to man. Yeah. And they're used for fission because they're so heavy that they're ready to blow apart, you know?
Oh, that's interesting.
Get a critical mass.
So
yes, it's hard. They're just at the edge of what Mother Nature can do, and in fact, beyond that, because plutonium doesn't really exist in nature. It's a man-made element. You've added additional neutrons to uranium to get plutonium.
I never heard this before. This is new to me, so I want to stop for a second and just go over this for people. We'll get a little physics here. That for those of us who grew up in high school chemistry and physics, we learned the periodic table. We learned about protons, electrons and neutrons. Hydrogen's real simple, And at the other end, you've got, uranium is the heaviest naturally occurring element. And then I remember these things, californium, lawrencium, plutonium.
That's
these things
right.
are so unstable. They don't last, right? They can't exist.
That's right. They have very short, they can't. They are so heavy that they're beyond the ability of the nuclear force to hold them together. So you can create them for very brief periods. Californium, for example, in an atom collider, atom smasher, so called, and scientists were making big reputations for a while in the late Cold War by making heavier elements. But it's kind of cheating, because these things, would last for fractions of a second, and then they would call it californium or berkelium or something like that, But come on, I mean, it's not like you could take it out and hold it in your hand and it would exist.
But it's interesting that the heavier the atom, the weaker the atomic forces to hold it together. I would think just the opposite, not being a physicist, that a heavier, a more complex mass of protons, neutrons, electrons would have more electric force, more electrostatic or whatever, more nuclear forces to hold the bonds together, simply because there are more of them in that atom. But that's not the case.
There are more of them, okay. Because you've got more atoms, more nuclear forces, but there's a limit to what that nuclear force can hold together. And as you keep adding neutrons to it, it starts exceeding its ability to, even plutonium, for example, starts degrading after two or three decades. And we've got concerns with our plutonium pits and our current nuclear weapons, about are they going to work, and the left argues, it'll last 100 years. But scientists who know what they're doing are saying, we never designed these things to have plutonium pits that might last 30, 40 years. The weapon was supposed to be replaced every 10 years or so, because the plutonium starts deteriorating, and because it's right at the end of the periodic table in terms of the nuclear force in terms of its mass and everything. Now, at the other end of the periodic table, you'll find elements like tritium, which means it's basically, it's like hydrogen, but it's got one more nucleus. Okay. So it's one of the lightest elements around. Same thing with lithium. It's at that light end of the nuclear table. And, what you're doing in a second generation thermonuclear weapon, you know, is you're setting off a small atomic bomb to use the light radiation. It's actually, you know, the light is so intense. It's hard to imagine light being having this property, okay? But you're talking about the cutting edge of physics here, you know, that the light will be so powerful, so close to that kind of an explosion, that it's that it will compress the lithium or tritium to the pressures that you would get in the sun to cause these things to fuse, and that releases even more energy than you could get from a fission bomb, much more energy. So now there's no limit to the explosive power that you can build.
So light energy, well, the sun's bright. Is there a connection between the sun and how bright the sun is and the hydrogen fusion that's going on within the sun and these lithium or tritium weapons? I mean, you know, and also the lasers come to mind of directed light.
Yes, you're creating, in effect, you're creating a small version of the sun. I mean, that's what a thermonuclear weapon is. It's a man-made sun or man-made star. And the sunlight that we look at, when you look at the sun, that's an ongoing thermonuclear explosion. That's right. What the basis of the energy that powers the sun is. You know, it's the equivalent of billions of hydrogen bombs going off every second, you know. And there's so much hydrogen fuel in the sun, you know, that it's burning that up. And eventually, though, it'll create heavier and heavier elements, and that's what it will eventually cause the sun to die, you know, because it'll run out of fuel that it can burn through the thermonuclear process. But it'll go through heavier and heavier elements. If the sun had more mass, you know, like a red giant, for example, it could last longer and burn more stuff, you know, and you know, but yeah, that's just, if you think of it, I mean, what a technological miracle that is, that man has actually gotten to the point that he can duplicate the processes that go on in the heart of a star and use it as a weapon. And that's the second generation weapon. Mm-hmm. And these weapons are designed for more blast and shock than you could get from atomic weapons, which, as I mentioned before, have a limit of about 500 kilotons. I mean, that's still 500 kilotons is an enormous amount of energy. But now you can get into the megaton area, you know, where we're talking about the equivalent of millions of tons of TNT. And an example of a really big, the biggest nuclear weapon that has ever been deployed is on this doomsday machine that the Russians are planning to deploy in a couple of years called Poseidon, you know, which has got a 100 megaton warhead. Some of the sources say 200 megatons, all right? The most powerful detonation we've ever had was the Tsar Bomba. The Russians detonated that. It was one of the last weapons that was detonated when atmospheric testing was permitted, and it had a design yield of something like 150 megatons. But it was so powerful that no bomber would be able to survive if they detonated it to the full yield. So they cut the yield in half or more than half so that it ended up being a 60-megaton test. And even then, the bomber crew barely got away from the blast wave so that they could do that. And as a practical matter, those really high yields aren't that militarily useful. You know, the weapons that are deployed.
Yeah, so destructive. You know, to use them is to lose the war. You know, we talk about chess and strategic placement and things like that. You know, they're so powerful that they're impractical to even the deterrent, because the deterrent factor is lost because you really can't use them. And they know that. We know that. We know that about their bombs too, which is probably why they cut the yield. I got a question for you when you're ready. Pianki wants to ask you a question, but let me know when you want to take that.
Okay. All right. But I don't want to run out of time before we get to the third generation weapons.
Yes, we're going to start that
having
next
this
week.
Conversation. But go ahead with your questions, and I'll.
Well, let's get to Bianchi here and see. I mean, I think we might want to start with third generation next week in detail.
Good morning, sir.
You know, the thing I was going to say, you talked about the sun and it's using up its hydrogen fuel. But for those climate changers, as the sun uses up its hydrogen fuel, its outer perimeter expands to, at some point, it will encompass, Mercury, Mars, and the temperature on Earth would be so hot it wouldn't make any difference anyway.
That would be climate change, but that's a while from now. I don't know how many X million years. We don't have to worry about it right now.
But that's exactly,
we'll be dust.
But that is exactly right. We've got another 4.5 billion years before we get to that scenario. But on the climate change point, though, the sun is the major driver of climate on Earth because the radiance of the sun changes. We now know that the thermonuclear processes that go on are quite regular. All right, but if there's a 1% chance of change in the radiance of the sun, that can make an enormous difference in climate on Earth. And has made an enormous difference in climate on Earth. And there's really nothing we can do about that, you know. So all of this bull that humans are, it's just that, you know, they have no conception of how unimportant mankind is, you know, when it comes to these huge things like climate, you know. It's a very exaggerated perception that that mankind, for all of our technological advancements and everything, hey, if the best thing they could do to protect climate and the environment on Earth is make sure that we never have a nuclear war. I mean, that's going to be by far the biggest thing we could do that would affect climate or affect environmental catastrophe. But anyway, the climate issue is another thing. I'm sure you've had shows on that before, but. You know,
we've had Gregory Wrightstone on.
The climate
had,
is not
some
changing
of the,
toward. You know, we're not going to face we're not facing a climate catastrophe in 12 years. Although that's a lot of the science doesn't support that. And if there was a climate catastrophe, it would almost certainly be because of some change in the radiance of the sun over which we have no control. But
why are we in a under minimum? Aren't we in a reduced solar flare period? It's like 30 years of cooling we're in for? That's what I've heard. Are you familiar with that at all?
Well, I don't know about the. I think there is a slight warming trend right now.
Oh, okay.
That we're going through that results in does result in a sea level rise of about a millimeter and a half to 3 millimeters. You know,
oh my
year.
God.
All right.
No, Obama's house might be in danger.
But that's
you got sunspot activity.
Yeah,
that's
you got unusual sunspot activity, which in effect reduced the radiation that's coming this way, thus by cooling. With the expansion of the sun, it happens miniatures at a time. It's not the ultimate next week, but every little bit that it takes to get there, you know, things begin to heat up. Because it's just getting closer. You don't become obese overnight or within a month or within a year. It takes time to become obese.
You know, Pianchi, I tell you what, for next week,
hasn't seen my weight since Thanksgiving, but that's another point.
Let's look into solar patterns. That might be something interesting for us to discuss next week. I'll see if I can get Gregory Wrightstone back. But we should do. We only have about 6 minutes left, so if we can, let's do a primer. Let's do like a preview, and let's start next week. First thing, I'll put it in my calendar about third generation, even fourth generation nuclear weapons, because we should know what we're up against and what we don't have. Americans need to know we don't have, and I can also send this out to our various congresspeople as well. This is kind of like their briefing. But if you want to sort of introduce what is new and what people don't understand, that when they have this image of the thermonuclear bomb in their mind, that's not the state of nuclear weapons today. It's a totally different world. So you can kind of give us a little preview of where we are now.
Well, third generation nuclear weapons, the whole family of new nuclear weapons, One example of them is a pure fusion weapon. So you don't need the atomic primer anymore. And that means the weapon is clean, because all of the radioactive fallout that people are very concerned about, in fact, it's one of the things people fear most about a nuclear weapon, it comes from the parts of the uranium or plutonium pit that are not fissioned. You know, those parts get scattered into particles as fine as dust, and that's where your radioactive fallout comes from. But if you don't need a pit, if you don't need plutonium, uranium in the weapon, and you can do it by pure fusion, now you've got a clean atomic bomb that generates, a clean nuclear weapon that generates no fallout. The weapon, and it can be big or it can be really small. And one of the other characteristics of the third generation weapons is selectable yields, so that it can be big or it can have an ultra low yield, a yield that's so low, you know, maybe a couple of kilotons, you know, that you could use the thing, for example, for tactical purposes, like taking out a bridge, or you could dial it up a little higher to take out an armored regiment or an armored division, or you could dial it up even higher, you know, to take out an airfield or, you know, some major strategic target. But now you're still talking about that's the blast and shock aspects, except now clean with no radioactive fallout. The more impressive third generation nuclear weapons aren't designed for blast and shock at all, but they are tuned for putting out a particular nuclear effect. For example, we've talked, let's start with the super EMP weapon, because we've talked about that many times on your show. And the way you get that is you have a weapon that's designed so that it's putting out gamma rays. You know, it's not designed for blast and shock. In fact, it has a very low explosive yield. The yield is inconsequential, and it isn't even what you're after. You're after the gamma rays. And it's the gamma rays that cause the E1 EMP effect. And so, in effect, you're tuning the weapon to put out a particular kind of nuclear effect. In that case, it would be EMP, and it will produce this low-yield weapon that might be only 1 or 3 kilotons, will put out far more EMP than a 20-megaton bomb, you know, because it's putting out a lot more gamma rays, and it's in a shorter period of time. And so it's much more efficient at generating the EMP effect. Another example would be neutron radiation. So the bomb is tuned to put out neutrons instead of a lot of blast and shock. And that can be used for anti-tank, anti-armor purposes, anti-aircraft purposes, you know, and another example is X-rays, X-radiation, a weapon warhead where it's tuned to put out X-radiation. This is almost ideal for anti-missile defense, because you can intercept adversary warheads in outer space without causing any EMP on the ground, because you're suppressing the gamma rays now, but you're putting out X-rays, which are a way of killing the adversary warhead by destroying the electronics. It's another way of killing electronics instead of using EMP to do it. You know, that was one of the reasons, by the way, why back in the 1970s we briefly had an anti-ballistic missile system called Safeguard, but we couldn't figure out, you know, how not to EMP ourselves while using this thing. You know, because
is important.
Right.
Yeah.
And people decided, you know, it was more dangerous to us than it was to the adversary, you know, but that's because we didn't have third-generation weapons that could suppress the gamma rays and focus on X-rays. The Russians have got them.
This makes no sense to me.
And the other part of it is because of the small size that you can actually... you can actually imagine a tank that can fire, you know, a mini neutron bomb, okay? So that when our guys go into battle, you know, we're using conventional explosives and, depleted uranium that doesn't have any nuclear effect, but one tank on the other side, you know, could basically take on a whole battalion of ours with a mini neutron bomb. They could actually have rounds like that in their tanks, or nuclear air-to-air missiles in their air forces, ultra-low yield or selectable yields for their naval forces, like this Zircon, although the Zircon doesn't need a nuclear weapon because this is one of the hypersonic glide vehicles. It's so precise.
Oh, I want to talk about those.
They can just use kinetic kill to take things out. The Russians just demonstrated they can do that last week. You know, this thing can go Mach 10 and hit a target so precisely that it just disintegrates from the kinetic force. But so this is the difference between, and it's a real revolution, you know, because these weapons are much more usable than the old first generation or second generation weapons, which are fundamentally designed for huge blast and shock effects. And they were designed for a different strategic environment, the era of the Cold War, you know. So
I've got to hold you up because we've only got 5 seconds left. No, I really have to hold you up right now.
Okay.
This is fascinating. I want to start here next week. And, of course, the big question is, you know, if these don't have the radiation, if they don't have the effects that people are all scared about, there's no reason not to develop these here. And so we need to find a way to get this across to our leaders that these are very useful, that they're just weapons. They may, you know, the fact that something, if you have a nuclear weapon without fallout, without radiation, there's no difference between that and a conventional explosion. In fact, it's probably less damage, especially if you're talking about neutron weapons. You know, yes, they're anti-personnel, they'll kill people, but they destroy property, don't kill people. I forgot which one it is. Whatever one is, you can explain it next week. But is there a source, just before I let you go, is there a source that I can do some research on these third generation nuclear weapons? Either an article or a place, or where would I find out about them?
I've written quite a few articles about them.
I'll get your articles then. Okay,
but I think you can Google, you should be able to Google third generation nuclear weapons and bring up some stuff.
It's not classified?
I hope you can anyway.
Okay.
Pardon?
It's not
no, this should not be. What I've been talking about, of course, is not classified, and you should be able to find stuff along these lines that's not classified. Okay. I've written a lot of articles about this. You might want to put down this name, Vice Admiral Robert Monroe. Okay, he's a friend of mine. He was the former director of the Defense Nuclear Agency, mm-hmm. and he has also, along with me, you know, been an advocate for, hey, the United States has got to develop third-generation nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
We can't afford to fall behind in this.
Well, there's no reason not to, because they don't do
the
things that people are scared of with
the
nuclear weapons.
We don't have them, by the way, is because the Clinton administration abolished the Defense Nuclear Agency. I mean, they were the tip of the spear for developing advanced weapons like that. I mean, people just don't realize the things that have been done that have brought us to this path, but that's something we can talk about next week, about how
we have to
get into this situation where we're so far behind.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's
let me
an
do
interesting
some research
story.
On it. I have to hold you up. I have to let you go. Otherwise, Blog Talk's going to scream at me. So let me let you go.
Okay.
And thank you so much for another fascinating hour. Let's pick up next week, third generation nuclear weapons in detail. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Have a good
Bye-bye.
Day.
There we go. All right. That's Dr. Peter Pry and Greg Pangloss for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Our new website coming out, writeyourlaws.com, the new and improved one, www.writeyourlaws.com. See you tomorrow morning, 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, 4 Pacific.